Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this Kingborough Council meeting on Monday, the 14th of December 2020. It's 5:30 p.m. and my name is Dean Winter. I'm the Mayor of Kingborough and I officially declare the meeting open. If you're not at the beach enjoying Kingborough today and you're watching us online, you may have made a mistake, but because you can always watch the replay later. But for those of us who are here and who can't be at the beach, we're happy to have you watching along. First act tonight is to check with our acting General Manager, Tony Ferrier, that the audio recording has commenced. And he has confirmed that it has commenced, just to let everyone know that the audio recording is not only recorded on Facebook and available for you to watch later, but you can also go online at our website and listen back at any time. Next item tonight is the acknowledgement of our traditional custodians. I'm actually lucky enough to have Sarah Wilcox at her last council meeting as an employee who's going to welcome us to country. Ms. Wilcox.
Thank you, Mayor. Ya, minapalininya, ninamapali, meladinapakana, Lutruwita too. Hello and welcome to you all as we meet on Aboriginal land in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This land that was never ceded. I acknowledge with deep respect our old people, the traditional custodians of this land, the Muwinina people, who cared for this country for over 45,000 years. I pay our respects to our elders, past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community who follow in their ancestors' footprints. This will be the last time I'll be able to pay my respects at a Kingborough Council General Meeting, and I'd like to thank the Mayor for giving me this opportunity. I've really enjoyed serving the Kingborough community over the past 5 years, and I've strongly believed in putting the community at the heart of everything that I do. Community, after all, is how our ancestors lived in harmony with this land for so long. The definition of community is a group of living things sharing the same environment. Our old people shared the environment with each other, with all the flora and fauna of this country, living through two ice ages, which is an incredible achievement. The elders preserved the traditional knowledge and passed it down through the generations so that their descendants were each able to play their role to preserve the health and well-being of their people, to manage the land and its resources, to survive the extreme elements, to trade and negotiate with their neighbours, and most importantly, to teach the young people all these things to preserve their community for the future. Unfortunately, the invasion and the brutal war that followed had a devastating impact, and everything changed and so much was lost. However, we survived and we continue to fight for our identity as rights holders of this land. Today, we have local government authorities who help us to manage how we share the same environment at the grassroots level. Our elected members are the leaders we trust to point us in the right direction. Council staff are here to help us all on the journey. This council has amazing people who dedicate themselves to manage the environment, to assist us to move about in the community, to help us during emergencies, to provide facilities for us to use, and to create opportunities for us all to connect. What makes this community so very special, however, is the diversity of community associations, groups, and individuals who volunteer their time and effort in making sure we know what is needed and when, who organise and manage so many great initiatives, opportunities, and events. I feel very privileged to have worked with them all, to witness their tireless and selfless actions in making Kingborough such a great place to live. The relationships with these community members and the support of my colleagues are the reason I'm so very proud of my time here as a communications and engagement advisor and what we have all achieved together. The term communication shares its origin with the word community. Communities have something in common to each other and are formed with a tie of communication. It is the foundation of community. So if there is no communications, there is no community. It therefore makes sense that the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the oldest continuing culture on Earth, use oral communication as their core learning system. Communication is about creating a conversation, and I have loved all of the conversations I have created and joined in during my time here. With all of the councillors here tonight and those I've worked with previously, with my supportive and very talented colleagues at Team KC, and with all the community members I've met along the way. Thanks to you all for making my journey so interesting, challenging, enjoyable, and rewarding. I look forward to actively participating with the Council as a resident and to continue creating conversations where I can to tell the truth of history and advocate for a collaborative relationship to empower our people and protect and preserve our heritage, our culture and our country. Ngiyari Ninatu, thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Ms. Wilcox, call you Sarah tomorrow probably. It's probably a good time to, it's not on the agenda, but it's probably appropriate at this time that we acknowledge that we have two of our staff members that councillors deal with a lot and also the community deal with a lot leaving us tonight, and that's usually our Deputy General Manager, but on short notice he's our Acting General Manager tonight, Tony Ferrier, and also Sarah Wilcox, and both of them are at their last council meeting. They're two of our most loved and respected members of our staff, not just by elected members, but by our community. And while elected members are and should be at the front of our community engagement, often it's our staff who are there dealing with issues and ideas with us. And so if it's not an elected member, it's often been Tony or Sarah who have been understanding what our community needs are and helping us to resolve issues and identify opportunities. Tony Ferrier started with us 14 years ago. He produces the most extraordinary amount of work that I've ever seen. No one can tell me what time he starts every day at work, and I've asked, because no one's ever beat him to work before. I did arrive at 7:30 this morning. The car was already in the car park, so who knows what time he arrived before that. He's the most reliable person to work with. He's been a rock of stability, reliability and patience for this organisation, and he will be truly missed. And while he's officially retiring, I'm delighted that he will still have some involvement with our organisation as he works with us and the other three Greater Hobart Councils for a metro plan, so he'll still be involved in our strategic planning, which will be fantastic. And we've already heard from Sarah Wilcox tonight, and Sarah has turned Council's engagement and communications around. From one, it sounds joking, but it's not such a joke. Before Sarah arrived, our Facebook page was mostly used to share pictures of lost dogs. And I don't think we did engagement particularly well. Sarah's turned that around. She has been an absolutely outstanding contributor to the way that we engage with our community and has lifted us up to being a council which is known for doing comms and engagement better than most other councils in Tasmania, and extraordinarily with only one member of the communications team. Sarah's pushed all of us, including me, to be more engaged, more consultative and more visible. And good news or bad, Sarah always wants to tell the truth. She always wants to tell our community how it is, and that's the way we've been operating with her, and that's the way that we plan to continue to operate in an authentic way, just as Sarah is. So thank you so much to Sarah and Tony for their contributions over the years to this organisation. They have been really valuable. I should say that we often lose members of staff and not all of them get a send-off, but they are two that our elected members have been working with for a long period of time. We've really appreciated and valued them. Thanks very much. Okay, now we've said all those nice things, back to normal business. Our attendees tonight is myself, Councillor Winter, and Councillor Westwood, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street and Councillor Reet. We do have a late note from Councillor Bastone, though. We expect her to be with us momentarily. And here's Councillor Bastone just walking into the room. From our staff tonight, we have our Acting General Manager is Tony Ferrier, our Chief Financial Officer is John Breen, our Executive Manager of Engineering Services, David Reeve, our Executive Manager of Governance and Community Services, Daniel Smee, our Manager of Development Services, Tasha Tyler Moore, our Coordinator of Statutory Planning, Melissa Stevenson, Communications and Engagement Advisor, Sarah Wilcox, and our Executive Assistant, Amanda Morton. Apologies this evening we have from Councillor Wass. I haven't said Councillor Grace's name because I have not had any word from him that he's not coming or that he's going to be late. So unless we advise later, he is an apology. Confirmation of minutes. Would anyone like to move that the minutes of the open session from Council Meeting Number 22 held on the 23rd of November 2020 be confirmed as a true record? Moved by Councillor Reid, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried. Workshops held since our last Council meeting. On the 30th of November, we held a workshop about the southern projects within the Hobart City deal. And on the 7th of December, we held a workshop on asset management. On page 2, we have declarations of interest. Does anyone have an interest to declare? We have none. Transfer of agenda items. Would anyone like to transfer an agenda item? We have none. We now move to questions without notice from the public. Usual spiel. We are still unable to host members of the public at our meetings in person, and we don't like doing that, but that's the reality of where we are. But it does mean that we've adopted live streaming and you get to watch this at home, hopefully with the air conditioning on via Facebook. But if you have a question you'd like to ask and you'd like to go on the public record, you can always email kc@kingbert.tas.gov.au, address your email to the General Manager and put your question in writing, and that will appear in the next council meeting agenda. However, that's not for another month, not until the third Monday of January. Okay, questions on notice from the public. At the time the agenda was compiled, no questions on notice were received from the public. So we now move to questions without notice from councillors. Any questions without notice? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions. The first one relates to a workshop we had a few weeks ago with State Growth staff in regards to the Huntingfield Park and Ride, and there was mention of the bus audits. It didn't appear to be very clear in regards to their progress on this, and I'm wondering if we have heard any further communication from them, and if not, can we please write a letter and ask them for a timeline?
Mr. Ferrier.
Through the Chair, I had a phone call on Friday, which is the latest information that I've received. The Department of State Growth are forming a working group of State Growth employees, Metro staff and Council staff. So they're just getting some names together at the moment. They will be looking at the audit as a whole. They've done a count of all the bus stops in the municipality, and they've identified how many are DDA compliant and not, and the vast majority are not DDA compliant. They've got some issues to be dealt with. So they've got a basic level of information about the bus stops. But what they'll be doing now is, with this working group, creating a framework within which they'll do the audit, the criteria by which they'll assess the bus stops, and then they'll move forward. On that, they'll identify which ones need to be designed and costed, and then they'll come up with a priority list of the bus stops that they feel need to be worked on. There's about $2 million of funding available for the job. They anticipate for the first 6 months of next year that type of pre-planning work will take place, and then the following 12 to 18 months through to the end of 2022 will mean the actual work on ground will get done. So we don't know yet how many bus stops will be dealt with until we go through that process, but that's the time frame.
Wonderful, thank you. I'm glad I asked the question. Just a further one on that. So they'll be looking at bus stops where there is no shelters as well to look at if they should build a bus stop?
Through you, Mayor, they'll be looking at all bus stops in the municipality. So their audit covers everything. Like I said, the focus will be on the DDA compliance, but they'll also be considering other things like shelter and seating and, I guess, some of the amenity issues which are needed in some cases. They'll also be looking at whether they're in the right locations and if they have to be shifted. Some bus stops could be possibly improved and where they're located, so they'll be considering that as well.
Thank you. And one more question. Last week, Mayor, I noticed that you had attended or held a conversation about a multicultural Kingbra, and I was curious to know what were any outcomes or understanding from that, please.
Look, I'll probably take it on notice because I'll take it partly on notice because I'll put everything in there. But broadly, the conversation was me explaining a little bit about myself, and I ran through some demographics that we got from some census data that talked about how our population was changing, and then we really just listened to some of the ideas and thoughts. The concerns or ideas raised from people who were just unable to find a job and were saying it's really tough to get the level of support living in Kingborough, and pointing to areas like Glenorchy with a higher multicultural population who were able to more readily get that support because there's a higher number of people from overseas there. That was a big one. There was some concern about that was a diversity of views. Some said that they felt absolutely welcomed in Kingborough and they love living here, and others said that there have been occasions where they haven't felt welcomed or safe, and safety was another big theme. So yeah, a real variety. But there have we took everyone's contact details, and Julie Alder-Fox from our community services team and myself have got a list of actions to go through that we're going to sit down in the new year and plan out how we resolve them. Councillor Reid.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions in relation to the delegated authority list on page 140 onwards at the back of the agenda. The first one relates to, I noticed that there seemed to be an exceptionally high number of retrospective applications within this group. There are, in fact, four, which is slightly alarming. I can't remember seeing so many at any one time. I wanted to check whether we could have an assurance that all of those retrospective applicants had paid the double fee as they were retrospective.
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, without individually looking them up, it's definitely common practice that they do have to pay that double fee. Of course, there might be occasions where the fee is waived, where someone has got a circumstance where they have come to council themselves because they've recently purchased a property and the people before it, and there's evidence that the people before it did the works. But yes, from memory, all these ones would have paid their fees.
Thank you. And another question, just specifically on one of them. So it's the one on page 142, DA 591 of 2020. It indicates here that there is a retaining wall and some stormwater works that were partially within the council road reserve. I'm just wondering if you could provide some detail on that, whether has the retaining wall encroached on that or is it the underneath works with the stormwater?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, the retaining wall was constructed without approval. It was brought to our attention and they had in fact built over our stormwater drain. So it's protected under the Urban Drainage Act, and the outcome was to realign that drain, and it's at their cost because there was an ability. You can't always do that. It really has to look at the merits, but it's dealt with under the Urban Drainage Act as well as under the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act, and it was also a matter under the Building Act as well as a non-compliant built form.
So the wall hasn't moved. They've just they've paid to rectify the issue with the stormwater drain. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, thank you. I had another question for the General Manager, which is awkward because he's not here. I just was wondering about on the report of his activities on page 143. On the 12th of November, he met with Southern Cross Care regarding the future of Mary's Grange, and I'm just wondering if perhaps the General Manager, when he returns, might be able to provide some advice on that meeting, because I'm sure there's many residents of Taroona who'd be interested in what the future plans are.
No one in the room was at the meeting. We'll take it on notice.
Thank you.
There are no other lights on. Councillor Cordova.
Another question regarding the General Manager's diary, which, you know, same as has just been said. Attended the TCCI State Budget Breakfast. My question is around whether or not it's predicted that the State Budget, how does that intersect with Kingborough Council's finances, and what's the relevance of that State Budget Breakfast to Kingborough Council?
Wasn't there, so I'll take it. I reckon we'll take it on notice. Yep. Okay. There are no other lights on at this stage, so we will move forward with the agenda onto questions on notice from councillors. The first one is on tinderbox curbside collection from myself. The second is on Bruny Island Emergency Management from Councillor Cordova. With that, open session adjourns. Planning authority commences at 5:49 p.m. Yes, that's where we are. DAS 2020-18 starts on page 4. There's a recommended motion. Page 15, would anyone like to move the recommended motion? Councillor Fox.
I would, but I'm a bit in the dark as to what alterations might be recommended by Council to this motion at this point in time. I mean, we've had email correspondence and...
I don't think there's been an alternative resolution prepared, to my knowledge, and so we'd be looking for someone to move the recommended motion.
I'll also move. Thank you.
Anyone like to second? Councillor Midgley. Councillor Fox.
I understand this is a piece of land that's being subdivided into three lots. It's in a low density area in Middleton, and the applicants are required to provide public open space contributions and vegetation protection, but there is room for this subdivision, and it is generally recommended for approval. Thank you.
Councillor Bastine.
Thank you, Mayor. I've got a couple of questions. On page 16, 2B, proposed buildings must be designed to limit the likelihood of bird strike. And when we go through them, no window can be bigger than 2 square metres. But the one that really worries me the most is the glazed surface of a window is installed at a minimum of 20 degrees from vertical, angled at its base to reflect the ground. Now, I think this is proposing a lot of limitations on someone who possibly only wants to build a small home, probably... I won't name any of the builders, but just an ordinary home. And this, to do what is required here, will take an architect's building and add to the cost considerably, I would think. And I'm just wondering if it really is necessary. That's my first question. Is it really necessary?
Ms. Stevens.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The conditions or the three dot points that are shown there are just solutions that if they were to deal with those, then that would meet the requirements. There are other options. So there is a guide, and these criteria come out of the guideline that's been produced by off the top of my head, I'm not sure who produced it, sorry, but there's a guideline to minimising impacts of bird strike. So the idea of this condition is to ensure that in the design process that people are thinking about how they design their building, and it would only be one of those options would be required if they had windows that were causing an issue in terms of their size or their location. So it is just an option that could be used, but it certainly isn't the only option, nor is it particularly necessary for that option to be the one that's taken.
Thank you. My next question is on the public infrastructure, which I presume is the driveways and the crossing from the road to the property. Is that the only public infrastructure we'd be talking about?
Ms. Davis.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. There is the crossovers to each lot, plus there is the stormwater infrastructure as well.
Right. Okay. And I've just got to find the last one. Yes, it's on the public open space amount. On page 19, number 12, no provision made for recreational space or improvements. It says it requires the security 5% of the unimproved value of the gross area of the subdivision, but we already have one house on there. So would it not be of the two remaining blocks that you would put the public open space on, or the two new blocks?
Ms. Stevens.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Council's policy talks about the public open space contribution on the gross area of the subdivision, and the condition was worded in accordance with that. It would be possible to amend that condition to refer to just lots 2 and 3, which are the vacant lots, which are the lots that create the additional demand on the public open space requirements. So it would be possible, but Council's policy does make reference to the gross area of the subdivision.
Right, but it is possible to amend that. Sorry, I'll turn my...
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The Council would have the ability to do that if they would like to, yes.
Thank you.
Councillor Street, and then Councillor Westwood, and then Councillor Cordova.
I just have a couple of questions, Mayor. Following on from Councillor Bastone, the stormwater works that would be the public infrastructure works that are considered by 14, 15 and 16, can I get an indication of what those works actually are?
Ms. Stevenson.
Please.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. I'm just trying to... Sorry. Okay. So the infrastructure that's required is that each new lot would need to be serviced with a stormwater connection. I must admit this plan has been reduced onto A4 and it's very hard to read the small writing, especially without my glasses. So apologies, but I understand that there's some stormwater. There's the council stormwater main needs to be extended to then provide the lot connections to the new lots. I might be able to see it better on the screen. Excuse me.
Also a small screen on the local.
Yeah. Slightly bigger than the printed out version, though. Sorry, through you, Mayor. I can't see the plans properly at the moment, but my understanding is that there's an extension to the council stormwater infrastructure that's required.
Yeah, the reason that I asked the question, Mayor, is that I couldn't tell either. There's certainly connections for each lot, but I couldn't see any extension. Yeah, by all means.
Can I suggest perhaps we can see if we can track down the answer? We do have our lights on, so maybe we could go to Councillor Westwood and then Councillor Cordova and then come back, Councillor, unless you've got it further. Or do you want to...
Well, look, I suppose the follow-on question to that is, if the only stormwater works are the connections to the lots or potentially a stormwater pipe running under the crossover, Would it be usual that we would require the bond spoken about in number 14? And if it were just a crossover, would we be asking for the bond?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Certainly, with subdivisions, with council infrastructure, it isn't uncommon to require bonds. The question, as you would be aware, had been raised by the applicant with regard to that, and it was reviewed by our development engineer, who was satisfied that in this case it was appropriate and was consistent with how we've dealt with other subdivisions of this nature.
Look, if we are able to answer the first part of the question, that would really help me. But
okay, so we're going to go to Councillor Westwood, and then when we've got an answer, we'll come back and Councillor Street can continue. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. I had a question as well in relation to condition number 9. We've had some representation that questions the head of power for that 2% fee, a council fee of 2% of the estimated value of the civil engineering construction works for the development or the current minimum fee, whichever is the greater, must be paid at the time of submission of the engineering design plans for approval. I'm just wondering what is the head of power for condition 9, please?
Ms Stevenson.
Through you, Mr Mayor. Our council sets the fees under the Local Government Act every year, and under our fee schedule there is a fee that requires for the engineering plan approval. There is a minimum fee that is set for works that... So basically it's calculated as 2% of the cost of works. If 2% of the cost of works is less than what the minimum fee is, then the minimum fee is payable. If 2% is greater than that minimum fee, then that fee is paid accordingly. So it's set through Council's fee schedule under the Local Government Act.
Okay, thank you. And then just in relation to conditions 23 and 24, which refers to a dedication of public land for road widening, I'm just wondering, it says for future road widening as required to be created as a separate lot. What is the likelihood that we would widen that road at some point in the future?
Ms Stevenson.
Through you, Mr Mayor. Probably can't answer that question in terms of what the likelihood is because I obviously don't have a crystal ball and can't see what might happen in the future. However, it's commonplace, well, it's standard practice for all subdivisions where there isn't already an 18-metre wide road reservation to take road widening, and that's what's provided for in the Local Government Building Miscellaneous Provisions Act. The purpose of the 18-metre road reservation is to include both the road pavement but also to provide for services as well, which may be required in the future. The when a subdivision is undertaken, it provides an opportunity for council to acquire that land, which obviously at then a point comes when council may need to widen or upgrade the road or install services or so forth. That land is already available for that purpose rather than having to go through compulsory acts which is issued on another timely and costly exercises.
And how much land is going to comprise that lot? I might have missed it, but how many metres squared?
Through you, Mr Mayor. I may just have a look at that plan on the computer again. It should show... yeah, so it's 264 square metres. Thanks, Tony. Shown on page... page 32 of the agenda, you can see the road widening lot shown as 264 square metres. Actually, that's just in front of, sorry, that's just in lot of front of lot one. So there's actually three, it's on the three different plans. So in front of lot one, it's 264, in front of lot two, it's 220, and in front of lot three, it's 209. So you're looking at about 684. Or 93, my maths serves me correct.
Yep. Okay. So is that usual practice to require the public open space contribution into our public open space reserve as well as an allocation of additional land for road widening?
Through you, Mr Mayor. They're two very different matters. So, yes, it is where the road reservation is not 18 metres wide. It is commonplace to require the road widening. So that would only apply in those circumstances, and the public open space would be applied generally across any new subdivision where additional lots and therefore additional demand were being created. They're two very different requirements in terms of taking the land and or the cash under different sections of the Act.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Just a question, not my substantive. The question relates to page 13, 2.5.4, removal of trees that are high conservation value. And it says here that the proposed tree removal is necessary for bushfire and safety purposes. So my first question on this is the proposed tree removal is necessary for bushfire and safety purposes for the future subdivision. So obviously the tree removal would not be necessary were it not for the future subdivision. Am I correct in that?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, certainly. So for a subdivision, they're required to do a bushfire hazard management assessment for each of the new lots being created. They've identified through that bushfire requirement that in order to be able to develop each of those future lots, certain hazard management area would be required for bushfire purposes, and they've identified within that which trees would need to be removed. And so we've, as part of this subdivision application, we're approving the tree removal in order to facilitate the future development of those lots.
Okay, so were it not for the proposed future subdivision, those trees, the high conservation value trees, would still be standing and would not cause a bushfire risk? I think that's what you've just said, yep. So my next question, thank you, it's just clarifying. So my next question is about what was the process to, I'm just trying to unpack this idea, what was the process to determine the necessity for tree removal? Who looked at what in order to make that determination?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. So with any application, the application is considered in terms of the information that's provided with regard to the impacts of that development on a range of things, including vegetation. So there are a number of issues when it comes to subdivisions that need to be considered. So one is the bushfire requirements, and the second one, of course, is the developability of those lots into the future. The provisions in the planning scheme specifically require council to consider the impact of future development of those lots when it comes to natural values and vegetation. So through that process and through further information and the information provided by the applicant with their application, there was a bushfire hazard management plan, and there were the building areas were identified. It was also looked at in terms of those building areas, what trees would need to be removed in order to facilitate that development. The applicant identified the number of trees that were required to be removed. That was assessed by Council's environmental planner. It was found that that was appropriate in terms of what the impacts would be, and the approval and the conditions accordingly deal with that.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thanks. And so am I right in assuming that Council's senior environmental planner visited the site to make that assessment?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. I didn't visit the site with her myself, so I can't for sure, but yes, I would say so, and certainly in terms of the information that was provided, it was certainly assessed by our environmental planner.
Okay. Yep. And so within the Biodiversity Code, to what extent do we take into account, to what weight do we give different threatened species, if any? And the reason that I'm asking this question is all councillors received a representation from the owner of the property saying that they have seen swift parrots pass through, but have never personally sighted any of them nesting. So we've got an admission from the owner of this property that there are swift parrots that have passed through on that property. So my question is, to what extent does the Biodiversity Code weight different levels of threatened species? And the reason I ask is there are 300 swift parrots left, but there are 615 pairs of masked owls left, and there's 10,000 quolls left. So does the Biodiversity Code say, well, swift parrots are, we should elevate the weight that we give to these assessments because there's only 300 swift parrots but 10,000 quolls?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. My understanding of the Biodiversity Code, the provisions in the planning scheme and Council's offset policy is that there are definitions of what constitutes priority values from an environmental point of view, and so they're classified as either low priority, medium priority or high priority, and it depends on what exactly those values are. My understanding is that the ranking, if you like, of the low, moderate and high would take into consideration the impacts on particular species. It's about habitat, it's about potential for habitat, and so I don't know that it specifically says the swift parrot is more important than the masked owl or whatever, but certainly in terms of the identification of the species of trees, the size of trees, the habitat that it provides, those things are all part of the factors that go into determining whether it's low, medium or high priority.
Thank you. And so in this particular case on this property, the priority was considered, I think it was medium, wasn't it? What was the priority that these high diversity, high conservation value trees were considered? might be on page 11.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. So there are two values on this site. There is the community value, which is considered a low priority. So the community, the difference there is the community is the species of tree together with the understory that goes to form the community. So in this case, the community is classified as a low priority value, but there are individual trees within that community that meet the criteria under the planning scheme and the offset policy to be medium priority values, and that is because of the size of the trees. And so the assessment in terms of the impact is on not of the community but on the individual trees, and the reference, I think it's 10 trees from memory, that that meet the definition of high conservation value trees, and those under the Biodiversity Code are considered a moderate priority value.
Okay, thank you. So now that we've ascertained that it's a moderate, it's been determined a moderate priority biodiversity value, is it fair to say that that's a subjective assessment? Is that a subjective assessment of the planner in this case? Like, because it didn't take into account swift parrots, for example.
Ms. Stevens.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. My understanding is that the classification as a moderate value was put forward by the applicant in their planning documentation that was submitted, and that was assessed by our environment planner against the requirements of the planning scheme and the definitions, as well as our offset policy, and it was agreed that that classification as moderate values that was put forward by the applicant was accepted as being accurate under the planning scheme requirements.
Okay, thank you. And so in this circumstance, did the Environmental Planning Officer take into account the admission that swift parrots were on the, had been seen by the owner on the property? Was the swift parrot being seen taken into account?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. I'm not able to answer that question because I don't know what the environmental planner necessarily thought for that. But in terms of, as I previously stated, the criteria by which we determine the level of value is based on what is defined in the planning scheme, and it relates to the species of the tree, the size of the tree, and the potential for habitat for a range of threatened species.
Thank you. So my final question, is there a chance that we knew that there were swift parrots that had been seen on this site and it was still given a moderate priority biodiversity value assessment?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. I suspect that could be the case, potentially, but as I said, the decision to say that it is a moderate priority value was based on the definitions under the planning scheme and the criteria which it met.
Thank you.
So I've got Councillor Reet, then Councillor Bastone, then Councillor Street. Councillor Reet.
Thank you. This is quite a complex matter, and I have to say at the outset it hasn't been helped by the fact that we've had now on the second occasion that this matter was going to come before us, some very late advice from people representing the applicants, which is difficult to digest given the complexity of it. So it doesn't make it easy for us as councillors to be able to seek all the information that we need in a very short time frame. I wanted to ask about the Part 5 agreements because the applicant's representatives have very firmly suggested that the Part 5 agreement is, I think they used the word somewhere, overkill or to that effect. And that caused me to go back and look at quite a few subdivision applications that we'd considered over the last 18 months, and I noticed that every single one of them had a Part 5 agreement in it. Can you just confirm that that is the case? And perhaps just for the purpose of the debate, just also let us know, you know, what the specific intent of a Part 5 agreement is.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, certainly Part 5 agreements and conditions requiring Part 5 agreements for subdivisions is very commonplace, particularly for subdivisions that are either occurring in rural areas or in residential areas that are subject to the biodiversity code and contain natural values, such as the case here. There are a number of examples where we have used very similar conditions, and those Part 5 agreements and those requirements have been successfully implemented in regards to those subdivisions. They've gone ahead, that we're now getting applications for dwellings being constructed on those lots, and the Part 5 agreements provide that control and direction that was promised at the subdivision stage, effectively. The purpose of the Part 5 agreement, so in order to be able to subdivide, you need to be able to demonstrate that you're achieving certain things in accordance with the planning scheme requirements. And where there are natural values and other things, of course, on the properties that need to be considered, and the impacts of those need to be considered. The subdividers or the applicants often say, well, we can develop these lots to demonstrate compliance with the planning scheme. They'll say, we can develop this lot in this way and we don't need to remove the vegetation. The purpose of the Part 5 agreement is to ensure that those outcomes that they're promising or that they've identified that they can achieve at subdivision stage are actually achieved in the future development of those lots. The provisions in the planning scheme very specifically require the impacts of future development of the lots to be considered at the subdivision stage. And the other thing is the planning scheme, when it comes to dealing with future development on lots created under this planning scheme, if there's a building area on the title, that provides a permitted pathway through the next step, but it only deals with that in relation to the buildings themselves or the habitable buildings within the building areas. So things like access, bushfire management areas, wastewater design and all of those other things potentially have those impacts as well. So they all need to be considered at the subdivision stage to ensure that the outcomes that are being identified as being able to be achieved are actually achieved. And it provides that direction for future lot owners to understand the needs of that development on that lot as well.
Okay, thank you. That was a helpful explanation. I noticed that in some of the other Part 5 agreements that we have approved in the last 18 months, that there was a bond payable for the 5 years. I'm written down somewhere for the 5 years of the agreement. For the cost of monitoring the Part 5 agreement. But I didn't see one in here. Is that because we've requested other bonds in relation to some of the other works within here, or what's the difference in treatment between these? Because the other bonds that we've requested in here for this DA, I couldn't see in previous ones that we'd considered.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. In short answer to that part of your question, no, they're very different things. The reason why we sometimes require bonds in other subdivisions is because in those subdivisions, often they are providing a conservation zone or conservation area to offset the loss of vegetation on the site. So it might be that they're removing a certain amount of vegetation and they're protecting the balance part of that vegetation in order to offset the loss of the vegetation. So the purpose of that bond and the conservation management plan and the maintenance and ongoing treatment of that is part of their offset package. In this particular case, the vegetation that requires offsetting is individual trees, and there is no area available on the site to adequately to offset, to adequately protect, to deal with the offset. So in this case, the condition is requiring a financial contribution of the $500 per tree. Mm-hmm. So there's no need for a conservation bond and therefore a conservation management plan, and therefore a bond to implement that conservation management plan in that case.
Thank you. Couple of other things. I noticed that there was there seemed to be an error and that there was a paragraph that was repeated. So on page 16 under part 2, the very last sentence there, which says all costs associated with drafting and registering the Part 5 agreement and title are to be borne by the developer, all terms of this agreement must be complied with once executed. And exactly the same point is then made at point 3 over the page on page 17. It just seemed to be an error.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The reason why that is repeated in both those conditions is because they're two different conditions requiring Part 5 agreements. Now, it is possible, so condition 2 is the Part 5 agreement that relates to the matters for the future development on the site regarding landscaping, the bird strike issues and protection of the individual trees. The condition 3 is the condition that requires the Part 5 agreement in relation to bushfire. So the provision is relevant because each clause is working separately. Having said that, it is possible and the developers may choose to do just one Part 5 agreement that deals with all matters, but for the purpose of trying to make the condition less complicated and difficult, they've been separated into two conditions.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to turn now to the legal advice that we received today, I think it was, or late yesterday, in relation to the public open space contribution and how that is determined, because the advice that we have been provided with by the applicant's barrister states that we have discretion for public open space to be paid in an amount not exceeding 5% of the whole area. Yet within this, it is a definite 5%, and I'm just wondering, could you comment on that advice, whether Council has advice to the contrary, that we have flexibility around that, whether it's just a flat 5% or whether we do have discretion to have it from anywhere from 0 to 5%, firstly?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. We, like you, only received this,
today,
we got to work, so we haven't had the opportunity to have proper legal advice in terms of a response. Certainly, it is possible to provide a lesser amount than 5%. It's certainly that advice is correct in terms of you cannot exceed 5%. Mm-hmm. In terms of without, if for example it was land, you can take more than 5%, but you'd have to pay for anything over 5%. In terms of a cash contribution, the maximum would be 5%. The Council's policy does talk about the gross area of the subdivision, as does the Act, so it does provide for taking 5% for the whole area of the subdivision, but I believe that there is some flexibility in taking a lesser amount lesser percentage, or potentially saying that it would be 5% of a lesser area. So potentially one option could be to exclude the existing dwelling lot and just take it on the basis of the two additional lots that create the additional demand.
And thank you. You've just answered my next question. I just was interested, though, in a comment on page 2 of the advice that we received, that it says that there's a procedure that generally, where the proposal generates an additional need for costs, a contribution will be required. But as part of the assessment, there is consideration of whether a particular proposal generates an additional need for public open space contribution. And I'm just wondering if we have any advice on that. Is that actually a consideration in the assessment of the need for public open space contributions?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Just to clarify, do you mean that is the increase in demand a factor that we should consider in determining whether we apply public open space contributions?
Yes.
Yeah. Certainly that is a factor that, yes, would be incorporated into any decision regarding the need for public open space. The purpose of the public open space contribution requirement is effectively to facilitate or to either contribute to by way of provision of land or cash to facilitate either the purchase of land or the maintenance and upgrade upgrade of existing infrastructure. The subdivision itself creates the potential for additional dwellings to be constructed, and therefore potentially new residents living in the area. That increases the demands on council infrastructure. So certainly that is a relevant matter to consider when determining whether or not to apply a requirement for public open space.
So given that it's zoned low density residential, how many dwellings could be constructed on the two new lots that are proposed under this subdivision?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The zoning is low density residential area A, and under area A, the maximum number of dwellings per lot would be one. There is no provision in the planning scheme for multiple dwellings in the low density residential area A. So the maximum number of additional dwellings that you would potentially have on those two lots would be one on each, so an additional two. Mm-hmm. The planning scheme does also provide the ability for an ancillary dwelling, so in theory that each of those lots could potentially have an ancillary dwelling as well, which is restricted in terms of its size and sharing services with the dwelling, so there could be a slightly more increase in the number of people.
But potentially we're talking minimum two more houses, maximum four if you include ancillary dwellings, and the number of people in each house. So we're potentially saying, on average, I think we have four people per household, so we're saying that eight more people created through this means we're taking a significant, you know, not insignificant contribution for public open space for eight extra people in an area. Seems a bit of a stretch to me. So I am tending to lean towards your suggestion that we could exclude the lot with the existing residents on it, and just take the contribution from lots two and three, so that we're actually decreasing the amount that is taken as a contribution. And so I'm hoping somebody has some words to that effect, so that obviously there are other people to speak, but that we could move that at some stage.
Ms. Stevens.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, we certainly have some words that we could provide for that.
So, Councillor Bastone, I think with a question.
Thank you. So, some more questions. One is about the 9-metre strip. The crossovers that are put, that then carry across the 9-metre strip, if you widen the road, that would move where the crossover is as well, and who would have to pay that cost of moving the crossover?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The crossover itself wouldn't have to be moved, and it depends obviously on...
It's a very big drain there. This is a street that I know quite well.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure what you're meaning by having to be moved.
Well, if you widen the road, the crossover will go from where the road is now to the property, then across the 9, and then they will have their driveway across the 9 metres of what will be council land. If, in fact, the road was widened, the crossover would no longer be against the road as it is now. It would be closer to their land, wouldn't it?
So as part of the subdivision works, they would be required to construct the crossover from the existing road pavement to what would become their property boundary. So once the road widening lot was taken, so the crossover would go right to their new property boundary. And then obviously if council, like it would in any circumstance where we might upgrade roads, we would have to obviously facilitate existing accesses through the roadworks. So any existing accesses would need to be maintained and rebuilt if need be, if that's what the roadworks required. But that would be done at the time the roadwork upgrades were done. We'd be factored into that design.
Okay, thank you. And my other question is, the two blocks directly opposite these two new blocks, which are 29 and I think 31, were subdivided, and I believe that there was a road widening allotment put across the front of those blocks too. So does that mean that this road would end up being an extra 18 metres wide?
Three, Mr. Mayor. So no, it wouldn't be an extra 18 metres, so it's 9 metres from the centre line of the carriageway. So the road widening that was taken on the other side of the road would have been taken from 9 metres of the centre line of the existing carriageway. So that would maybe 1, 2, 3, however many metres it needed to be to do that. And this would be the same on the other side. So you would end up then with an 18 metre reservation from the centre line of the carriageway.
So that's 9 metres on each side from the centre?
From the centre line, yes, not from the edge of the carriageway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. I think I answered my own question in relation to the stormwater works. And so on that basis, I've just got a couple more questions. Crossovers are the responsibility generally for maintenance of the property owner. Is that right?
Ms. Stevenson, or Mr. Reeve is nodding his head and thumbsing up.
I was about to say that was my understanding, yes.
Yes. So in a crossover where there's a culvert underneath the crossover to allow the passage of stormwater, are we responsible for the culvert under the crossover, or is the property owner responsible for the culvert under the crossover?
Mr. Reeve's thumbsing up again.
It's the property owner. Okay. So on that basis, I think, from what I can tell from the plans, the only public infrastructure that we would take ownership of are the stormwater connections to Council's table drain, I think. And I don't know whether anybody is going to be able to confirm that for me, but I think that that's the case. If that is the case, I'm wondering, and Mr. Roy may say that he simply has no idea, whether he has a ballpark figure on what such a connection would likely cost, or a range.
Mr. Reeve.
Thank you, Mayor, for bringing me into the conversation. Yes. So for property connections, it does depend a little bit on the length of the property connection there. They can vary from anything from about 1,500 to 3,000, maybe a little bit more, depending on what it happens to be. So they would generally, from a council perspective, there goes from the IO back to wherever they make the connection into whatever the drain happens to be. So it's hard to tell in terms of, without actually looking in a bit more detail, but they're the type of costs you're talking about.
But that bit's definitely our responsibility to maintain.
It's definitely our responsibility to maintain those ones. Yeah.
Okay, so on that basis, I think what I've got my head around is the idea that the only thing that the bond is going to apply to, it seems to me, is those connections to council's stormwater and not the crossovers. Again, I don't know whether anybody can actually confirm that or not, or is prepared to do that tonight, but... Okay, well, I'll just be happy in myself that that's the conclusion I've come to.
Okay, Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Council colleagues, for your many questions that have clarified some thoughts that I had. The Part 5 agreement was extremely important to hear and clarify that. I do note that we have the representative for the applicant is worried that it will hold up the development and take a lot longer due to this Part 5 agreement. Can we just have some clarification around that, please?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The Part 5 agreement would need to be drafted by the applicant and submitted to Council for review. The recent changes to the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act have introduced timeframes around Council's assessment of compliance with conditions on planning permits. So there are now timeframes in place which would ensure that any review and subsequent responses back and forth in relation to Part 5 agreements, or for that matter any condition compliance on a planning permit, would be done in a timely manner. I don't see that it would unnecessarily hold up the ability for works to start. Of course, you know, it depends obviously on how the documentation is submitted and whether or not they've addressed the requirements of the condition as to whether or not we'd have to go back for further information or not, which potentially could delay things, of course. But provided that we have a template as well, which we would happily provide to the applicants, which makes it a lot quicker and easier, because if it's done in our template form, we know those parts of the agreement are all okay. It's just a matter of checking the specifics for this particular application. So I wouldn't see that it should unnecessarily hold up or delay the project.
thank you. And just a few more points again from the representative for the applicant. A few of the questions regarding the conditions. The condition 7 stated this condition is unnecessary given that a detailed tree removal plan has been provided and that the trees which will remain on the site will continue to be protected by both the planning scheme's biodiversity code and its relevant bylaw. I think it's an important one to keep, but I'm just clarifying that as perhaps why they would have suggested that one.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. So, yeah, it is true that they have provided details of the trees to be removed. And the purpose of the condition is to make it very clear and explicit as to what has been approved for removal and what hasn't. So it's effectively conditioning that, yes, you have approval to remove these particular trees, but you don't have approval to remove anything further than that, and also the requirement that they can't remove the vegetation until they have start of works approval, which is to ensure that people don't go and just remove the vegetation and then never proceed with the subdivision, because of course the purpose of the removal of the vegetation is to facilitate the subdivision. So the condition really is just reinforcing, yes, this is what we've approved, but nothing more than that. You can't approve, you can't remove anything else, and you can't remove any of it until you've got your start of works in place.
Thank you.
It's a standard condition.
Thank you. An important one that I see. Condition 18 as well, there's a question on that saying, and the representative states there is no fill greater than 300 millimetres proposed. Feels that that one is unnecessary.
3 Mr. Mayor. Because the engineering drawings haven't been completed at this stage, we can't be sure whether or not there is or isn't fill exceeding 300 mil required. Certainly, if there isn't any fill required that exceeds that amount, then there's no issue. It's just a standard condition because at this point in time, we only have proposal plans. We don't have detailed drawings. And until we know for sure, we require that condition to be included. If they don't have any site filling that exceeds a depth of 300 millimetres, then there's nothing more for them to do in terms of satisfying this condition. It's considered to be satisfied.
Thank you. And just further on from what Councillor Cordova mentioned before regarding the swift parrot breeding habitat on this area, it is a really extremely important species to protect, and it's great that we have the agreements and clauses and mitigation to look at how we can protect the breeding range, the nesting possibilities and the species that are available for them for the future in this area.
Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to move an amendment, please, to clause to condition 12 in the recommended motion. And it's the wording that's been provided previously by Ms. Stevenson. Thank you. I don't know whether Ms. Morton has that. No? Yes? Excellent.
Oh. Don't underestimate it all.
Do I need to read it? Do I need to read it, Mayor?
We probably... Ms Wilcox, can people at home read this? They can now. I think we've upgraded. Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that basis, the amendment is as written, and I can explain the general effect of it.
Yeah, that'd be
my
good.
Contribution,
yeah.
If there's a second.
Yes, so moved by Councillor Street and seconded by Councillor Reet. So, Councillor Street speaking on the amendment.
Mayor, all the amendment seeks to do... is change the public open space contribution from being for all three lots on the proposed plan to just the new lots 2 and 3. I say new lots, they're all new lots, but lots 2 and 3 and the lot 1, which has the original dwelling, would be excluded from requiring from us requiring a public open space contribution. The reason that that I'm happy to move this amendment in this case is that it's a subdivision of very small size, as Councillor Reet's already indicated. I accept that there is an increased demand going to be created for public open space in any subdivision, and that's why I think it's good that we take a public open space contribution. That will be the case here as well, despite it being in Middleton. I think, as has been pointed out, Council's placing a significant amount of money into Silverwater Park, which will service any residents of these new lots as well, and increased demand, however small, on the public open space in the channel. And so I think it's appropriate that we take something, but in a subdivision of this size, I think it's reasonable that we only take that contribution on the new lots which are likely to create that new demand. I think in larger subdivisions, the situation is different because across a larger subdivision, that tends to be a relatively insignificant amount comparative to the contributions taken on every other new lot. But I think in a subdivision of this size, it's appropriate that we take it on only the new lots.
Thanks, Councillor Street. Councillor Fox.
I have a question. How much is the difference between the unimproved value of the two lots compared to the unimproved value of the gross amount? What is the financial difference?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. So the requirement is the unimproved value of any of the lots. So the fact of having a dwelling on that title won't change the value of that land because it's the unimproved value. Obviously, until a valuation is actually done, it's hard to be quantitative about what that amount may be, but I suppose you could roughly say it would be two-thirds the cost. The lots are fairly similar sized lots, I think, in terms of their areas, so it would just be the value of the two lots rather than the value of the three lots that would be used to take the 5% of.
And the other question is, would this be setting a precedent where a house which is recognised by the owners as having been there a long, long time and probably no public open space fund has ever been taken by council for the creation of that lot because it's so old, if we get future subdivisions like this, will that then mean that we'd be applying the same rule from now on? Is this a precedent?
Stevenson.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Council would need to consider every subdivision application on its merits and determine what is the most appropriate form of public open space contribution for each application. So in some circumstances, land may be preferable because there may be a connection to existing public open space, or sometimes cash would be. So I think the answer to your question really is that each case would need to be considered on its merits, and I wouldn't see that this would specifically create a precedent.
Councillor Bastani.
May I give an explanation of a lot where this has already happened? I did a small subdivision prior to being on council.
Doesn't sound relevant to
two till three.
DA. Really?
Sorry?
Doesn't sound relevant to the DA that we're...
Well, it does with. In so much that Councillor Fox said this would have a precedent. We only paid on the extra lot, the public open space, not on the three lots. So that was an explanation that it has happened before.
As so often happens, it seems when I interrupt people, it actually takes longer than when I'm...
Good point.
...to interrupt. So I do try not to. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I disagree with... not just the amendment, but also the intention of the amendment. And the reason is that, as we've just heard, it's cutting the funds that we'll be receiving for this service by a third. If you went into a pizza store and there's 10 people in front of you and they all order 60 pizzas each, and then you get up to the counter and say, I'd like three pizzas, please, can I get a one-third discount? They would say, no, you should pay the price of the pizzas. And so in this case, you need to pay the price of the subdivision. You do not get a discount just because it's a smaller subdivision than a larger subdivision. The reason that we have these fees in the first place is in order to offset the public open space requirements. There's a reason and an intention behind these. And to undercut the intention and the reason behind it is what this amendment is doing. And I hope I've made my metaphor clear that you don't get a discount just because you don't get a discount.
Well, I don't think we need to get it, though.
You don't get a discount just because it's a smaller subdivision. You don't get a discount at any other shop just because your order is smaller than the person
okay,
in front of you.
That's better. I'm with it.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
All right. Let's move, unless Councillor Street wants to sum up. we might deal with it. Councillor Street? No, please don't. No. It would. Okay, thanks everyone. We're just voting on the amendment now. It's moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Reid. It's to amend condition 12 as follows, and it's on the screen and it'll be available in our minutes. So all those in favour of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against?
No.
We'll have a division. All those in favour of the amendment, please raise your hand. Councillor Street, Bastone, Reid, Westwood, Midgley and Winter. Sorry. Those against is Councillor Fox and Cordova. The amendment is carried. So back to the substantive motion. Okay, Councillor Westwood.
Well, this might not be directly relevant to my hat as a member of the Planning Authority, but as someone sitting here without...
Have you made a substantive...
No.
You asked a question.
Asked a question.
Okay.
As someone sitting here as someone who doesn't have a background in planning, as a member of the public who was elected to the council to represent ratepayers, I find this incredibly confusing. I feel really sorry for the people that are trying to subdivide their land. They're three lots. They're really big lots, 3,000 metres squared approximately for all of them, and there are 7.5 pages of conditions. And I find them very confusing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.5. So that's my contribution.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. This has been a really tricky one, and I'll start by pointing out that in the Kingborough Land Use Strategy about Middleton, it does indeed say the strongest character statements or directions for the Middleton and Lower Channel area that came out of the public meetings in 2006 were the peaceful rural village character of Middleton should be protected, forested skylines, riparian areas and coastal foreshores should be protected, local historical and heritage features should be protected, and importantly, rural subdivision restrictions should be relaxed under certain circumstances and in the vicinity of the village. It goes on to say that the need for Middleton Village to be further developed and reinvigorated and the promotion of local historical and heritage features, those are the issues that are most important. So one of the representatives' submissions did indeed say, we don't want Middleton to stagnate, we want it to develop, and this will be good for the economy, it'll be good for the people who get the benefit of living in the subdivision, it will be, you know, good for the town. And I don't disagree that we don't want Middleton to stagnate, and indeed the zoning of this particular property allows, under some circumstances, for a subdivision to take place. So I've spent a lot of time deliberating this. And whilst the planning scheme is clear in parts, each parcel of land is different, and no two towns, villages, communities, or indeed streets in Kingborough are exactly the same. And that's why when members of the public look at local government decisions, it can sometimes be a little bit difficult to understand, you know, why councillors are going in the particular direction that they're going. But before I became a councillor, there are many places that I would drive past and think, you know, who allowed that to go ahead? And of course, nobody was breaching the planning scheme when they allowed that to go ahead. But the subjective nature to which the planning scheme allows means that different councillors, when acting as a planning authority, will give different weight to different elements. And so what we're here to do tonight is to, in our judgment, as a planning authority, give certain weight based on our best understanding of the proposal before us. And as I said at the outset, this proposal for a subdivision is one that is not so clear-cut. To me, the proposal rests on the discussions contained in item 2.4, and whether or not councillors acting as a planning authority agree with the planning officer's opinion about clause 12.5.1, lot design, and E10.8.1, biodiversity code. Do we, as a planning authority, agree with the assessment that the performance criteria are met? So we've heard, in the question that I asked at the outset, we have heard that all these councillors have correspondence from the proponents saying that they've seen swift parrots passing through the property. And we've heard the fact that there's only 300 swift parrots left on Earth. And that doesn't come into it when acting as a planning authority. Nowhere in the planning scheme does it mention swift parrots specifically. But what it does do is impact whether or not we agree or disagree that this proposal meets the performance criteria. And so that's what I'm getting at right now, that the senior environmental planner might have known that there are swift parrots on this site, but still gave this site a moderate priority biodiversity status, regardless of that fact. And so this is where we come into disagreement. I disagree with that assessment. I know that the Biodiversity Code, and indeed the entire planning scheme, do not specifically talk about swift parrots, but I also know that our own Kingborough Council Biodiversity Code fact sheet says, and I'm quoting, for development impacting on moderate and or high priority values, any remaining values must also be retained and improved, and any adverse impacts offset in accordance with the guidelines for the use of biodiversity offsets. And Kingborough Council Policy 6.10 says, in addition, impacts on high priority values will only be allowed in special circumstances where it can be demonstrated that these impacts will not substantially detract from the conservation status of that value. So my question is, and it's a rhetorical one, how can the removal of 5 high conservation value trees on this site meet the performance criteria? The assessment of the planning officer is that it can, and I respectfully disagree with that assessment. There were 6 representations in favour and 4 against. One of the submissions in favour was from the owners of the land, and another one was from the person who plans to live on the newly created subdivision. So 2 of the representatives in favour of the subdivision obviously are, you know, they're the owner and the person who's planning on living there. So I think it's fair in this case to paraphrase the words of Mandy Rice Davis. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? So while all the issues raised by the representatives are raised in the summary page of the report we have before us, unfortunately, to my mind, the submissions both for and against were mostly very brief and remarkably undetailed, making it very difficult to judge the extent...
Time.
I request 3 more minutes, maybe, if anybody wants to listen for 3 more minutes.
I need someone to move. I need someone to second. The motion is that Councillor Cordova be allocated 3 more minutes. It was moved by Councillor Mitchell, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against?
No.
I have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillor Fox, Cordova and Mitchell, and those against is Councillors Street, Bastone, Reid, Westwood and Winter. Motion is lost, and so that ends Councillor Cordova's contribution. It was. That's actually democracy. Okay, so for my contribution, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things I heard during the debate. A remarkable number of questions that were asked of you set a record in my 6 years. You answered them all. Can I clarify, though? I understand that there is potential habitat for swift parrots and masked owls on the site, but is there actually evidence of those species on the site?
My understanding is that the vegetation that exists on that site has the potential for habitat for those species. I'm not aware whether or not they have or haven't been sighted on that site. But the planning scheme, in terms of how it classifies the vegetation and the values associated with that, relates to
the potential.
Yep,
thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. Just things important that we don't get too hyperbolic about it, and we focus on the facts. There are potential habitat there for endangered species. We're aware of that, and that's been provided to us in the advice. I have to say, I haven't heard a representation be attempted to be lessened because somebody wanted to live in the home before. Actually, I think that elevates it in my mind. Providing housing is actually something really important to this council, and I personally think that it's really important. And when Councillor Cordova talks about each councillor coming to this council with their own set of priorities and their own interpretation and subjectivity, I totally agree with that. And I have to say that when I assess these, a home for someone to live in is a very, very high priority, and perhaps higher than others. I struggled with the first thing. I struggled with representations. I think I would have been... I'm very disappointed with the timing of the representations. For the public record, this was supposed to be dealt with at our last council meeting, but at 3 o'clock on that day, we received a detailed email from a representative of the applicant who made some good points, but unfortunately it was made with 2.5 hours before the meeting, and that made it very difficult for councillors to assess, and so it was deferred. And again, yesterday we received an email from a representative of the applicant with some legal advice that had been written on the 5th of this month, so some 9-8 days earlier. Again, I thought that was perhaps ill-timed, and if we had been provided with their representation earlier, then it might have been better for them. What strikes me about this is that I don't believe this should be a particularly difficult subdivision application, but it is so complicated, so frighteningly complicated. The report is very complicated, and maybe that's no one's fault. Maybe that is just the way things are, and I've heard that a million times before, but it is still, I think, broadly a problem for this council and for others. I don't want to digress too far from this application, but this looks too complicated for someone to simply build a couple of homes for people to live in. I personally would prefer if there wasn't the some of the conditions involved, but I'm not hearing any support for that, and that those conditions that I particularly, I think the Part 5 agreement is too onerous, and I think that was touched on by Councillor Bastone in the debate. As I said, we're all entitled to our own points of view on that, and I've read the room and don't think I would have any support for it. So to sum up, Councillor Fox on the substantive motion. Councillor Fox.
Well, I think it's been a very educative discussion, and thank you for all the questions and the detailed answers. And planning is complicated, it has to be complicated, but we don't make it complicated as a council. It's complicated because the state government planning legislation is complicated. So I don't think we can get around that, and we just have to roll with the punches. And I recommend the motion. Thank you.
Okay, the motion was moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Midgley, and it's the Planning Authority resolves that the development application for the subdivision of three lots at 28 McDowell Street, Middleton, for Southern Planning be approved subject to the following conditions. There are quite a number of them, but just remember that one of them was amended, and that was number 12. Yes? 12? Yes. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Over division, all those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillor Street, Bastone, Reet, Westwood, Fox, Midgley and Winter, and those against, Councillor Cordova. The motion is carried. We move on. Next item. The Planning Authority session adjourns and the open session commences at 6:55 p.m. What about if we get through one more report and then have a break, or would people prefer a break now? One more? Okay, open session. Yeah, that's true. No, that's right. Well, we all get 5 minutes, the same amount as each other, so it's good that we keep that consistency. Motion which notice has been given. At the time the agenda was compiled, no notices of motion had been received. Next one is petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned. Petitions received in the last period. At the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions have been received. And at page 35, we have officers' reports to council. And the first item is the annual budget mid-year review. And the recommendation is on page 40. Would anyone like to move or second that? Moved by Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Fox. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. This is our mid-year review of our budget. It's probably not quite mid-year because we were a bit delayed in setting our budget this year, although I guess we are halfway through the financial year. Our forecast underlying operational result is a deficit of $1.88 million against the budgeted figure of $2.6 million. Recurrent income is expected to be $750,000 over budget, while expenditure is forecast to be $200,000 over budget, leaving a $550,000 improvement in the underlying deficit for 2020-21. That's good. That's much better than we were anticipating. I do note, though, that there is still quite a bit of uncertainty around at the moment. Tasmania certainly seems to be going really well, but we can't, get overly confident about that. I did have a couple of questions, and I'm sorry I didn't email them through earlier. In regards to the rates income, our rates income is currently $65,000 over budget.
how much cash have we actually received in revenue from our rates as opposed to the rates that are attached to individual properties?
Mr Breen, and for the remainder of this debate, all the questions you can just assume are to you, Mr Breen. No need for all the three of you rigmarole.
Okay, through you, Mayor. Basically, at the end of November, councillors, the rates are around about $690,000 in arrears. That is about double what we had at the same time last year. So we certainly have seen an increase in the level of arrears in rates.
Thank you. So while the revenue we expect is over budget, we actually haven't received the cash. We haven't actually received the cash.
That's correct, yes. So it's through the Mayor. Essentially, what we do is we account for the rates as they are charged, and essentially we will receive them at some point in the future, but the actual cash is about $690,000 less than what's in the reports.
So can you make a forecast of what the end of year position might be like in terms of rates owing in arrears?
It's a bit hard to tell at this stage. The rate revenue, the level of arrears is decreasing month on month. As of December, we've started imposing interest and penalties in an attempt to get some of our members of the community contacting council and having a discussion about their arrangements and hopefully entering into a payment arrangement with council so that we can start clearing some of these arrears over that period of time. But look, generally we're always around about $300,000 or $400,000 in arrears, so you'd imagine it's going to be up by $200,000 to $300,000 potentially.
And does that have any material impact on our cash position? I mean, obviously it does, but does that put us under any increasing pressure in terms of not having that money to be able to spend?
Through the Mayor, no. The arrangement this year, and it'll be the same for the next 3 years, is we've entered into some interest-free loans with the state government, ostensibly to support the outcomes of the pandemic. So that's certainly going to support our cash flow for the next 3 years. When we have a discussion about the long-term financial plan, we'll have to have the discussion about how we manage our cash flow from that 3 year point onwards.
Thank you. And I do note that an efficiency dividend of $380,000 has been outlined. So thank you for those staff that made the effort to come up with those savings. I had a couple of questions around the capital expenditure. It says in the report at 5.2, the total capital budget as of the 11th of November was $14.18 million. And expenditure and commitments at this date was $4.63 million. So that's nearly 33% expended and committed at the halfway point. Do we have a breakdown of that $4.63 million into expended and committed separately?
Through you, Mayor. It's probably around about $1 million. I'll tell you what it is at the 30th of November, so just to show you how quickly these things move too. So at the 30th of November, the total's about $5.4 million, and of that, about $1.2 million is committed and the rest is expenditure. So there's about an extra $800,000 that's come on in the last couple of weeks or so.
Okay. I noticed a couple of points in the report, it says that the capital program is currently tracking under budget, but an evaluation of each individual project suggests that they are deliverable within the 2021 financial year. I know that historically capital programs are hard to roll out in their entirety. I'm just wondering if you could provide a little bit more information around the confidence you have that we will be able to expend our capital expenditure program.
Mr. Reid.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. So bearing in mind that these figures there, there's about $1 million worth of identified deferrals or savings that are actually there, so that actually adds into that, if you like, that underspend, and I guess that's the reason why we do this mid-year review. The two other projects there that aren't talked about in this particular report there, but ones that you need to be aware of, are money to be spent on the CBD works there, so that is actually going to be a three-year program there, so there's about $450,000 from memory that's sitting in that particular council contribution there that may or may not get expended, but more than likely will be rolled over as part of the substantive project. And the other one there that may be in some sort of doubt of being spent this year is the Silverwater Park, only because there's still ongoing work with design and consultation and so forth there, and possibly that will form another report to council at a later stage there.
You're talking about the 250?
The 250,000, yes.
Thank you. I had a question about the Suncoast track with the coastal protection works that are being undertaken. It mentions in here that the longer-term solution will be to provide some coastal retaining wall works and more permanent fencing. Do you have any idea of what that permanent fencing might be? Because I have been contacted by quite a number of residents who don't like the look of the temporary fencing, and just wondering whether it might be more aesthetically pleasing in a permanent form.
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor, yes. So that would be the intention there. So at the moment there, it I guess, looks quite serviceable, but we would be looking at something which is more fitting with the landscape in that area there, and probably integral to some of the other works we're doing with the retaining structure as well at the same time.
Thank you. The path itself looks very nice. Could you please provide an update on the Blackmans Bay toilets, the disability access at Kingston Beach, in front of the Kingston Beach toilets, and the Tyndall Beach toilets upgrade, please? Are they on track to be completed this financial year?
Through you, Mayor. So one of the areas we are having some difficulties with all our building works there. So finding contractors is extremely difficult in that area there. So we have put the Blackmans Bay ones out to quotes, went to a number of different people. Most of those elected not to show any interest, pretty much saying that the earliest timing was probably something around about 9 to 10 months away. If you're lucky. So we only had one viable quote come back for that, and that's quite a bit over the budget as well. So we're finding that is happening quite a bit. So we suspect that we will probably go ahead with the Blackmans Bay toilets there. Tyndall Beach is a little bit doubtful at this stage there. We're still going through a design process with that one, but if it plays out the same way as Blackmans Bay, that may be difficult. The other one, which is the disability access or the access across the road there, that's actually been tendered out, so we're waiting for some tendered prices back for that one.
Thank you. And is there any possibility of including the Taruna toilets in this year's capital works program so that we can make a start on getting some quotes so the work can be done for next summer, given that 9 to 10 month lead time?
Through you, Mayor. I mean, we can certainly do some internal investigations there. In terms of any substantive expenditure, you're going to come into the same sort of problem that we're actually having with any of the other building works. So we can certainly get a head start, if you like, in terms of those, in terms of doing some of the investigation on it. So we've certainly been doing a lot of evaluation of some of our toilets, particularly from a disability perspective there, so there's no reason why we can't look at that at the same time.
Thank you. That would be really great.
Next I have Councillor Reid, then Councillor Cordova, then Councillor Bastow. Councillor Reid.
Thank you. It's made for interesting reading, and as Councillor Westwood has already indicated, it was indeed surprising that, given the circumstances of 2020, that this has come out more favourably than we anticipated at this point of the year. I've got a couple of questions. The first relates to the budget efficiencies the efficiency dividend savings that were identified, and I'm just wondering if somebody could comment on the process for how they were identified, because as you would recall, the council decision was just about the quantum amount, and councillors then asked that the general manager work with staff to identify the savings, and I just wonder if we could have that process articulated for us, please.
Mr. Breen.
Through you, Mayor. As a result of the request from council, the management team, which meets on a regular basis, commenced a discussion around what are the appropriate areas that we could target in regards to looking for the efficiency dividend savings. So over a number of meetings, the managers went away and went through their budgets. We decided to take a risk-based approach. In some cases, there was very little risk in cutting some of the expenditure. In other cases, there is a small risk, but it's not considered to be significant. Some priorities were made around particular projects that could be delayed, and essentially, once we got all the responses back from the managers, it was considered a Manex meeting. There was a discussion around some of the things that were in and some that were taken out, and eventually we came up with the $380,000 that met the commitment to council.
Thank you. So just off the top of your head, because we don't have the figures in these papers, what's the total arts budget for council?
Mr. Breen might be able to answer. Do you have any questions for Mr. Reeve while you wait for the answer?
I do, but I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, yeah. The total arts budget is $133,000 in expenditure.
So there was $13,000 cut from that, which seems to be a disproportionate amount. I say that as a former arts minister. And I'm just wondering, in other items here, it talks about reduced demand because of COVID. Were these items such as materials and contractors for arts and the Youth Art Prize, were they so heavily hit, or was that area so heavily hit because there were reduced activities due to COVID? Because that's not adequately explained in this.
Yes, through the Mayor. I think there's probably an element of two things there. One was the previous year, both those numbers were, the actual as well, it was under budget, which certainly gave the opportunity to relook at those levels of expenditure. I think there's also, I think throughout a lot of the expenditure levels, there's a lot of activities that have been reduced due to COVID and due to the inability to conduct some of the minor projects that we had underway. So that was the reason behind that. And certainly for the first 6 months, for both those, we are well under budget in regards to expenditure in those areas.
OK, thank you. Could you also just explain to me what recreational planning is? It took a $5,000 hit, but I wasn't quite sure what that item related to.
Through the Chair. So essentially recreational planning is planning around our recreational activities. The budget is $10,000 in that area, and we've cut that back by five. So once again, it's one of those activities where there is some discretion around the amount of work that that can be done in those areas, they just are focusing on other components of their workload rather than the actual planning component for this 12 months.
So I'm still not clear what it is, though. What area? What? Who leads this work? What? Can you give me some examples of this sort of work?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor. So our recreational planning budget is that used by our recreation officer, and historically that funding's been used to engage consultants to do a feasibility report or work in relation to a proposed walking trail or particular recreational asset.
Okay, thank you. And my other question on this, I was disappointed to see that Love Living Locally has taken a $5,500 hit, which seems quite a substantial amount. It indicates here that a scaled-back version of the event will be run, I assume, in March next year. Is that out of necessity because of COVID restrictions? And what is now the case, given that some of those restrictions have been substantially lifted? Will we have sufficient budget to run an event that I would imagine, after the year that 2020 has been, that the community would be really looking forward to?
Mr Smith.
Through you, Mayor, the planning for all events has been really difficult, given that the regulations have been regularly changing. And even now, we don't know what the regulations might be in 3 months' time, but as it currently stands, the intent is to deliver an event that has a reduced capacity in terms of attendance. And certainly a recent vegan fest that went ahead has shown that these major community events are able to go ahead with a reduced number of community members attending, and that's our plan for Love Living Locally, but it is somewhat of a moving feast in terms of the changing regulations.
Thank you. The other item on here, workers' compensation, $40,000. I do have to make the point, I don't think that's really an efficiency at all, because it was savings, because we got some premiums refunded, and I think that is a little bit too clever to say that that's an efficiency, because I'm sure if I went to the board of the organisation that I lead and said that we got some workers' comp premiums back and that therefore I'd made a budget efficiency, that they would laugh me out of the boardroom. So I disregard that one as being an efficiency. It's a coincidental thing that happened. It's not something where we made reductions. However, moving on, the other question I had was in relation to, and this is for Mr. Reeve, I was pleased to see that there was comment here about, and it's on page 38, the park furniture upgrade, and that there'd been an audit done of park furniture. I hadn't, unless I'd missed it in a previous report, I wasn't aware that that was being done, and it does seem to have identified, as it says here, over 400 items of tables and seats that need to be replaced or repaired, but we're going for a upgrade option. And I just wanted to check, when the audit was done, did it take into consideration things like disability access for those items? Because that is a significant factor in many of the picnic tables that we have around the municipality. It's not possible for somebody who is in a wheelchair to actually sit, you know, as part of the side of it. Is that sort of thing being looked at, or was it merely just looking at the condition of them?
Through you, Mayor. Look, it was primarily looking at, some of them are very run down for anybody who's actually been out there and had a look at any of our furniture there, unfortunately. So it's primarily looking at the condition part of it, but that's not to say that we shouldn't also be looking at the disability requirements as well at the same time there. So clearly for some of the areas there, particularly the ones which have some more high profile and higher use as well, they're the ones which may end up being more expensive type installations there to allow for that in those areas in particular. So the actual, if you like, the upcycling of these particular tables that's been looked at is pretty much actually looking at both the legs of the table and the surfacing of the table, so replacing the treated pine surfacing there with a hardwood surfacing there and with a natural finish over the top of it, as compared to a painted type arrangement that you actually see at the moment there. But look, I think it is a good point, and one that I'm happy to actually pass on there and make sure that that gets taken into account. Bearing in mind that what we're talking about here is the start of a longer term program, so this will only deal with a very small amount for this particular financial year.
No, I appreciate that, because it's talking about, you know, and it's a substantial amount over 5 years, but I think it is important that if we are renewing these assets, that we do it in a way that we make them as accessible to as many people in the community as we possibly can. It's not just the picnic sort of tables and seats that are a problem, but the standalone seats pose a problem for elderly people or people with disabilities when they don't have arms on them because there's nothing to push them up. And I'm sure the Access Committee would be more than happy to provide any advice in relation to that as may be required. So I am really pleased to see this being done, but I wanted to point out that on page 40 in the recommendation at 9D, it was actually missed off the list. So there is a list of the other nine items that we're going to endorse reallocation of $1 million to, and the it needs another dot point to say park furniture upgrade $40,000 because it's not in that list. So if I could,
if we could... that amount would fall under the GM's delegation though, because he's, I think his discretion is up to $60,000.
There's other ones here for $40,000 and $50,000, so I really want to have this on there.
Okay. Are you happy to put it on? Mr. Reeve, have any comment before we...
Yeah, look, I agree. I think it's just an omission there, so it's, it'd be good just to get an amendment for it so it's actually just listed in the minutes.
So if I could move an amendment to add another dot point to 9D.
I'm sure Councillor Westwood and I would agree to add that.
You'd like
definitely.
To
it's an
that?
Oversight.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, thank you. So that it would just read park furniture upgrade $40,000 as an additional dot point. Thank you.
Councillor Fox, are you happy with that? And Councillor Westwood is happy with that also. Excellent. Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Bastone. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I will try and speak quickly, lest my councillor colleagues try to censor my opinions yet again. And something might...
No. For the record, councillors haven't tried to censor you, Councillor Cordova, because there's a lot of people watching this. There are, under the meeting procedures, each councillor is allocated 5 minutes to speak on the substantive contribution. They're also allocated additional questions which are used in the previous debate, and you asked a number of questions, went for quite a period of time to which you were allowed to do, and then you said, I'll commence my substantive, to which you did, and then you asked for additional time and a democratic vote said you didn't. You haven't been censored tonight and I think you should withdraw.
I'm willing to withdraw, and thank you, Mayor. Something must have happened to the space-time continuum because that contribution from Councillor Reid was much longer than 5 minutes.
Well, thanks, Councillor Cordova. I will respond to that. Councillor Reid was actually asking questions for the majority of the contribution, and the answers actually took quite some time. In one case, Mr. Breen was asked to find the amount for the entire arts budget, which took him a little bit of time, and I think we can be lenient with questions. In fact, not we can be. We have to be, because there is no requirement, or there's no limit to the number of questions that you can ask.
Thank you, Mayor, and I seek your indulgence for that leniency as well. My question is, did the implementation of the efficiency dividend disrupt or delay any council works or services?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Look, I guess essentially, well, it has to, because we've had to take what I indicated, a risk-based approach to reducing expenditure, and so therefore there will have to be some sort of impact. The aim was to minimise that impact as much as possible, and I think we've done that fairly successfully. One that I would point out is the road sweeping contract that we now have with Huon Valley Council. So we've reduced our road sweeping across the Kingborough municipality by around 20%, and that's now been going for almost 6 months, and to our knowledge there's been no complaints about the quality of road sweeping. So it does demonstrate that that risk-based approach has been successful, certainly in regards to that particular area.
Thank you. Mayor, how did that affect our relationship with the Huon Valley Council by exiting out of that arrangement?
Mr. Reeve? Mr. Breen, I don't mind.
Through the chair. No, sorry, we didn't exit from that arrangement. That was us entering an arrangement with Huon to provide them a service. So I think they're extremely happy that they've got a service I'm not sure whether it's, assuming it would be at a better price than they currently had before. For us, it's a reduction in the level of work that we're actually doing ourselves in our municipality. But to date, that seems to have been very successfully managed, and we haven't received any complaints. So in essence, it's reduced our expenditure by $80,000, and Huon now have the advantage of us providing a service to them.
Thanks very much. So we've talked fairly extensively about the slashing of the Youth Art Prize and the school holiday program and the materials for arts. And I guess, on a side note, I'm quite incredulous that it was Councillor Reid that brought that to the Chamber's attention, Councillor Reid having been one of the people who voted for the efficiency dividends, which have now slashed the Youth Art Prize, the school holiday program and materials for the arts. Seems like a bit of a mistake. But what and how long will it take for us to recover what has been lost from the school holiday program, the Youth Art Prize and materials arts?
I'm happy with whoever, but Mr. Smee?
Through you, Mayor, I guess I'd start off by pointing out that it wasn't finance who slashed those budgets. That was done in consultation with the program officers that actually run those programs, who offered up them as potential savings. So they took the view that with 12 months ahead of us, this was back when we were doing our budgets, with the cloud of COVID hanging over us all, that they weren't going to be able to deliver the same level of service as what we've had in the past, particularly in that event space. And so those particular budgets were offered up for this particular financial year as a reduction. What will it take to get them back? It will take them to be submitted in next financial year's budget for consideration by council, and I would imagine that, assuming that the world is back to normal, that there would be an expectation from those program officers that those budgets would be restored.
Thank you. So through you, Mayor, is the intention of the staff, therefore, to advocate to fully replace the lost money? If I'm reading it correctly, it's because there was a diminution in the demand during COVID, and now that COVID is no longer affecting us to the same extent, is it the intention of the staff to advocate for a full replacement of that arts funding that was lost?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, I would expect so.
Thanks very much. My next question is about the RICI Action Plan projects. So the Regional Climate Change Initiative Action Plan lost $10,000, and the plan is to be considered in the 2021 budget. Can you elaborate on what action items we missed out on implementing as a result of the $10,000 cut?
Mr. Breen.
Through Mayor. Look, essentially the feedback I've had from the Environmental Services Manager is that due to COVID restrictions, extra commitments for the year have not been made by the group, and therefore the contribution from the council was essentially not required. So I think as a group they've struggled due to COVID restrictions in completing their program. So that money in essence wasn't required.
Thanks. And the next two items down, the Adventure Bay modelling. Remind me what the Adventure Bay modelling was.
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor, yes. So essentially this is flood and inundation modelling and mapping. So that's what's been postponed.
So we've postponed flood and inundation mapping during La Niña. Like now that La Niña started, that's when we've decided to postpone flood and inundation mapping. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Okay. Do my council colleagues know what La Niña is? What about the Don Tricasto Channel Environmental Project?
Keep going.
Thank you, Mayor. What about the Don Tricasto Channel Environmental Project that lost $10,000? What did that entail?
Through you, Mayor. Look, essentially, the feedback from the Environmental Services Managers is that this collaboration group is being wound up prior to the end of 2020, so the funds were not required.
Okay. My last question is about weeds. So we've heard a bit about transport roadside slashing, $50,000 slashing providing reduced ability for extra activities. Am I right in thinking that there was no major diminution in slashing from roadside? From slashing that. That's what we heard a bit before, wasn't it?
Mr Breen or Mr Reeve?
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Look, essentially, with our roadside slashing, we have a contract. It's around about $150,000 per year, so we have a set contract, which is to come in and slash the whole municipality. We then have an additional about $90,000, which we use then as a subsequent target dollars to target specific areas where we have a need. So we did that activity towards the end of last financial year, and to date this financial year, I'm not sure exactly what the timing is, but they're about to do the work again. So we've been able to sort of delay sort of further into this financial year to actually do the work. So essentially we've cut that back to 190, so after we do this full slashing we'll have $40,000 left to target specific areas, so that's the reason why that one's been cut back.
Okay. And my final question through you, Mayor, is about the transport weed spraying. Weed spraying from $51,000 reduced to $41,000, resulting in reduced spraying, so a $10,000 reduction in spraying. I'm not a horticulturalist, as you'll know, Mayor, but my understanding is that if you don't spray weeds, that they will come back thicker and stronger and more of them, which will in turn result in more weeds, which then cost more to get rid of. And also, if they're travelling from the side of roads, then they may go onto private property, upsetting and indeed damaging property values for landowners and people involved in agriculture. So my question is, with the reduced spraying, firstly, can you explain the extent of the reduction in the spraying that took place, and also how much do we estimate that it will cost to recover from the increase in the weeds that weren't sprayed? What will it cost to landowners and farmers also, who might have more weeds on their property because we didn't spray their roads up?
Mr Reeve?
Through you, Mayor. Look, it's a modest reduction in the weed spraying budget there. It still means that you still get the value for your service. There's a slight reduction in the service for the year there. It depends each year as you know. Obviously, some years are more buoyant than other years when it comes to weed control. And so we tend to try and adjust as we can during the year anyway. Yes, I agree that it has been a slight reduction there. In that side of things there, do we think it's going to have a long-term effect? No. So it's only a very much a short-term effect. I guess if you continued on with actually having a permanent reduction in those types of allocations, that's when you might start to see an effect.
Thanks. And my final question, Mayor, do you agree with the premise that reducing weed spraying results in greater costs later on because there's more weeds?
Mr Reeve.
Through you, Mayor, not necessarily. I mean, I guess that's basically what I was just saying then. I'm saying that they will vary each season as to where you're actually at with weeds. So some seasons it can be quite large and therefore you end up having to adjust some of your costs anyway, and other seasons it can be less. That doesn't necessarily translate that if you don't actually do all that weed spraying that year, that the next year there it's actually going to be a greater expense to actually try and deal with those weeds. It might mean that you have more weeds and it's more unsightly in particular areas there. That's probably more the more likely outcome out of that.
So was it just a coincidence that this $10,000 reduction coincided with the efficiency dividend, as in this year was a year when we didn't need as much spraying as we did in previous years?
Through you, Mayor. I mean, if you bear in mind that we've been looking at these efficiency dividends from when it became a council resolution there, so it's very difficult to tell exactly what your season's going to be. But bearing in mind, we also had something that we needed to actually try and seek in terms of getting an efficiency dividend. So we had to look across the board at a number of different areas there, and that's just one of those areas we needed to look at.
And so similar to my question previously, with the arts funding, is it anticipated that council staff will advocate for a full amount of money to be reinstated to the weed budget to replace the lost 10,000 in future years, depending on what the season looks like.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. So the intention would be to actually try and reinstate that particular figure. It also takes into account whatever might actually happen during the year there. So we look at all our budgets every year there and actually say, what's actually happened there? Is there any adjustments that need to be made? What's our service level for these particular areas there? And so you'll find that it's quite dynamic in nature in terms of that. But our intention would certainly be to look at some of these areas there where there may have been some temporary service drops and look at recommending that they're actually put back in place.
Thank you. And so does that mean that in general, over all of the efficiency dividend savings, in general, is this a saving or is it mostly for the line items that we're talking about simply a deferral of costs that will have to be replaced and replenished in years to come? So was this a saving or was it just a deferral of spending to future years?
You're through in there. Look, I guess essentially it's a mixture. There are some areas that we've been able to highlight where they were over budget and essentially we're budgeting for more than we actually needed. One I'll point out is the new equipment and furniture. So we'll change our process there because essentially every department would say they need $1,000 to $2,000 worth of new equipment and furniture every year, where in essence we don't tend to spend about half of what's predicted. So we'll now put that into one budget. We'll have one bucket. The bucket will be appropriate and people will be able to take money out of that particular bucket. So there's some areas like that. Consultancy is another one that can go up and down a little bit. But I think in essence we've got some areas where we've reduced our service slightly, hopefully with minimal impact. We certainly haven't seen any significant impact to date, so we haven't had many complaints at all. So there'll be ones where decisions will need to be made next financial year in regards to whether we restore that back to its pre-efficiency dividend level or whether council want to continue accepting those cuts and making those savings. There are others where we've deferred a project. Once again, that will be a decision for council. The money will be, I'm assuming, the manager will want that money put back into the budget next year, and therefore it'll be a decision of council whether we want to move forward with those projects.
Thank you.
Next I have Councillor Bastone, then Councillor Mitchell, then Councillor Street. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you. I have two very short questions to Mr. Reeves. The Groom Ridge Road ceiling, the additional bit, that's at the high point, not at where the steep section joins the part that you sealed last year, isn't it?
Through you, Mayor. So, so there's Oxys Road that's been sealed, and the two of these projects came up together there, and there was a community meeting going back many years ago about the sealing of both Groombridge Road and Oxys Road. So we've sealed Oxys Road there. The section that was already approved by council to do was the steep area of Groombridge Road there, where it's actually relatively unsafe. And then by doing that, what we've also identified is the fact that there's now a small section of Groombridge Road in between what will be the new sealed section and the old sealed section at the end there that will be remain unsealed, and it's an opportunity, I guess, to actually finish off that road as a completely sealed road.
Good, thank you. And my other question is, going back to the weed spraying, do we keep a record of how many people are now asking to be on the no-spray register compared to 10 years ago? Would you be able to get those figures for me?
Through me, I don't know if it would go back 10 years, but we certainly would have a record of people that have been on the no-spray register for the last few years at least. About how far that goes back, I'm not sure, but I can certainly provide that information to council or yourself.
And in your belief, is it increasing each year?
Not overly much, I don't believe. So, you know, there's people who come and go. So there's generally what you find is that the people who have been there for a while and on the no-spray register obviously stay on the no-spray register. If you get other people that actually move in there and want to do organic farming or whatever it happens to be, then you get some additionals on there as well at the same time. Has it increased significantly? Not necessarily from my knowledge. But, look, I can get the figures for you there and that'll prove whether I'm right or wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Reeve. That's all.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a few questions and comments. Thank you, staff, for the very detailed report and understanding of where our budget is at mid-year. The first question or comment I have actually around weeds. I have heard in regards to weeds, there has been actually quite a significant amount more than previous years due to that lot of rain we had prior to spring. So I just wanted to make that comment. And that was from council staff when I was out on a walk with community members concerned about the high number of weeds in certain areas. A point around the Suncoast, the fence there, I've had some comment from local residents who are happy that council is going to be working with them in regards to the coastal erosion and perhaps the development of a fence. And just a point for us to remember that coastal erosion and damage highlights the importance of putting council's climate policy into action with significant dollars for these. Unfortunately, we're going to see more of this and significant erosion to our coastal areas in the future, so just that highlighted that for me. Thanks to Councillor Reet for the point around park furniture and adding that to the list. I'm actually quite interested to see the audit and wondered at perhaps if it was similar to the playground audit. I thought that was quite thorough. And if that could be either in a report or as an attachment, it would be interesting to note because we do get residents contacting us about different furniture and be interesting to know which he's given priority and also for disability access. I think that is really important that the committee there sees such a report. Would that be available?
Through you, Mayor. So it was an internal-based thing, so it wasn't an external report. So it was more to do with internal staff doing that. But what I could do is get a summary of that, and I can add that into the next works report, if you like, so it's the end of there.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. Another point, and I have spoken to staff in regards to this, and I think that it is a really important one, is the link to Spring Farm from the Sports Centre. And I cannot see it in the capital works. I'm just wondering, how can we note it down to ensure that this happens? I know that staff are working, they're acquiring land, and there's a few other details in regards to that, but it has come on and off our conversations over the past year, and the development goes ahead, and there is still no walking track to the sports centre. How can we ensure that this is on a list, that we can see action to this and some progress being made?
Through you, Mayor. Look, I guess there's a couple of ways you can go about this. I mean, you could put forward an alternative there in terms of this report there to actually add it in there. Or the second thing is there, we can add it into part of our capital works we actually have at the moment there. So we do have an allocation for future design works there, so that just allows our design guys to actually start working on projects that are likely to come up in the future. So we can certainly add it in there as a sub sub project in there as well at the same time. So either or would actually suit.
Thank you. I'd be happy if it was noted under future design work so that it is noted there, and that would need require an amendment unless other councillors felt passionate to put forward an amendment. Councillor Fox thinks an amendment. Sorry, I haven't got any wording for such an amendment.
I think it's quite... Can I speak? I think it's very important because it's something that's been raised for many years by the bike committee, and also when that subdivision went through, it's been looked at for different locations, and if we could design it now, it would be worth doing.
Three, Mayor, look, I mean, you could either do it that way, or as I said, we as council officers will start doing some work on it this financial year anyway, as part of and any costs associated with that would go through our allocation that we already have for future design works. If you wanted to note it in here, you could note something down along the lines that council officers undertake a feasibility study into a linkage between the sports centre and the Whitewater Creek Trail or Spring Farm development, either one.
Yeah. So I think everybody's looking at Ms. Morton.
Do you mind adding another dot point, that, and just adding a dot point that says
council officers undertake a feasibility study.
Yeah, I think it just has to say feasibility.
Okay,
yeah, just that. Sorry, just say feasibility study. Feasibility study potential for food for.
Yep.
Amanda, do you give the words?
I think that sounds good. Sports Centre to Spring Farm feasibility study. Thank you, Councillor Reid. Thank you. Very exciting.
Did you want to add yours? Councillor Westwood.
Sports Centre, Spring Precinct to Spring Farm linkage. Is everybody happy with that?
No.
Oh, no.
Well, whilst I support that project, I think that given we have
Now you're debating it. No, we're not debating it.
I've heard that there is no cost associated
with just before we move on, though, so the mover and seconder, who was the mover and seconder? Sorry.
Joe and
Flora. Ah, right. Okay. So you're asking for Joe and Flora to... Councillor Fox and Councillor Westwood to agree to potentially to change the motion. Councillor Fox, are you? Yep. And Councillor Westwood, are you happy? You're not happy, which means you need to move an amendment to add Sports Centre Precinct to Spring Farm linkage. I take it you'd like to move that, Councillor Mitchell?
I would. Can I just ask?
Seconded by Councillor Cordova. Now you can ask a question.
Thank you. I was wondering if Councillor Westwood was concerned that there would be money associated with that study, and can I have some understanding from staff? From my understanding, at the moment, there will not be any money associated with doing such a study. Some of the works are underway. It's just about putting it down there to ensure that we move along from it and we can check in how it's going. If I can just get some clarification.
Mr.
Reid.
Through you, Mayor. Look, that's largely correct. I mean, effectively what we will do is we'll flag it as a project there to be undertaken this financial year in terms of the feasibility side of stuff. We will look at a budget we currently have for most of our future designs that come up. So we'll use that budget to actually... pay for those works that we need to do.
Okay, any further comment on debate on the amendment? Okay, the amendment is to add a further dot point to D as follows: Sports Centre Precinct to Spring Farm linkage. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? Motion's carried unanimously. All right. I think that was my fault.
Thank you. I have one more comment, just that it's great to see the Conyngham to Snug feasibility for there. I think the residents will be really happy to see this. It's something they've been campaigning for a number of years, so that's really great that we can move forward with that. I also think another project that is really important that isn't on the list is the Margate to Kingston feasibility study that came out of the Channel Corridor study, and I have spoken to council staff about that, but for record and for other councillors to understand, wondering when we're moving forward with that one.
Mr. Reeve?
Yes, through you, Mayor. We're certainly waiting for some of the effects to come down from that Channel Highway Corridor study, so there's a number of projects there that were listed as priorities as part of that project. So we believe that will probably come into possibly the state government's next year's budget. So what we probably will do is look and see if we can... encourage the state government to provide some funding for that attribute, considered as a high priority during the project. But either way, we would certainly like to flag it as a future project for next year.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a list. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I just want to make some comments in relation to the efficiency dividend savings. And I do this because I think that the casual observer watching this debate tonight might have the misunderstanding that the efficiency dividend that was something that was conceived in a vacuum out of nastiness on the part of council or out of an uncaring nature. And the reality is anything but the efficiency dividend... was conceived when we as a council were considering a budget in the middle of a global pandemic of size and scale that living memory doesn't recall.
Point of order.
And of economic scale.
Point of order on relevance.
Take the point of order.
Is a history lesson about the origins of the efficiency dividend got anything to do with the current deliberation about this motion?
Yes.
Relevance.
It's relevance. You've asked whether... So your point is that...
It's irrelevant. Dividend. Like, why are we going on a historical tour about what people felt relitigating a debate from May 25th, which has nothing to do with the implementation of the efficiency dividend, which is what this report relates to? The origins and the intentions of the people who voted for or against it are completely immaterial to this debate, so it's irrelevant.
No, I don't agree. Continue, Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I find the attempt to censor me rather interesting, actually, all things considered. Rather than ridiculing the sacrifices of staff and departments at this council, I want to thank staff for the commitment that they've shown to the efficiency dividend across all departments. Particularly, I'm hesitant to single out any particular group or department, because I really do sincerely thank every department of council and all of our staff for sharing the burden of this time with council and with our ratepayers. But I mean, look, particularly the innovation of the Works Department, I think, has been really welcome. So I thank them especially. As I say, the reality is that these efficiency dividends were not something that was conceived out of an uncaring nature or nastiness. We needed to share the burden with our ratepayers. That was what they expected of us, and that is what I'm proud to say that our council has done, and it's in no small part due to the staff of this council and the sacrifices that they have made to projects that are important to them, and I really sincerely thank them for that, rather than, as I say, taking the path of ridiculing their sacrifice. So I thank them again.
Yeah, on the efficiency dividend, I have to agree with Councillor Cordo that some of them are deferrals. They're not planned to be continual, and in fact, most of them are not recurrent. So they're going to be one-off savings, and we've heard from Mr. Smee in particular about some of them just being purely a function of COVID making things difficult, and also Mr. Breen talking about some of the climate change ones where we just purely couldn't actually get the work done this year due to the restrictions. But like Councillor Street, I agree that the works, actually the heavy lifting's being done by works here, and the particularly that deal with the Cuyn Valley looks like it's a product of the efficiency dividend. It's going to be ongoing in nature, and potentially good for residents in the Huon Valley and Kingborough. So that's a really good outcome. I have to say, we did set Mr. Breen and Mr. Arnold's quite a task with this, and we knew it was ambitious, and I didn't expect that we would get through the whole thing, but it's important to set a target or a goal. But I have to say, you know, donations reduced due to COVID restrictions is not an efficiency dividend. But I love your creativity in attempting that. And I do appreciate that it was really tough. So thanks for that. As Councillor Westwood noted, the budget is looking much better than, I think, if we had sat around when we formulated this budget. This is a mid-year budget review, and we're sitting here halfway. If you'd offered this budget to me as a midway point, I would have absolutely taken it. We're in a much better position than I thought we would be in, and I'm very pleased about that. To sum up debate, Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't plan on saying too much, just to say thank you for the additional things that were added. I do support that sports centre precinct, Link Road, just in terms of governance. I would prefer that we actually voted on a new budget initiative. And just to note that Yeah, we are tracking quite well at the moment, thanks to a lot of hard work to from the staff. And I hope that our capital works program does come to fruition, because that obviously supports businesses within our municipality and other municipalities. And I thank you for the mid-year review.
The motion was moved by Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Fox. And it's the council A notes the progress on the operational budget for 2021, notes the savings identified to deliver the efficiency dividend in 2021, notes the progress made with the delivery of the capital program, and D endorsed the reallocation of approximately $1 million in identified savings and project deferrals to the following projects. They're listed in the agenda, but there's also been one added, which is the park furniture. The two added, park furniture upgrade and the sports centre precinct to Spring Farm linkage. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motions carried unanimously. I think we need a break, don't we? Yep. So for those on Facebook, we'll leave the live stream on. We'll be back at 8:05 p.m., 12 minutes. Welcome back to the... What's next? Next item is our risk management policy. It starts on page 54 and there's a recommendation on page 55. Mover and a seconder, please. Moved by Councillor Cordover, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordover.
Thank you very much, Mayor. And we're looking here at the risk management policy. And so firstly, I'd like to thank the author, Mr. Breen, for bringing this to us. Essentially, the attached policy has been reviewed by the audit panel, and there are a few minor changes that have been made, as identified in the markup copy, which you can see. The main change is essentially that the main change to the policy is to align the types of risk with those being used in the risk matrix. And Council's risk management framework, risk appetite statement and strategic risk register are being reviewed by the audit panel. So I thought I would invite Mr. Breen to comment on the risk management policy and highlight any of the main updated changes or any commentary that he thinks is relevant.
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through you, Mayor. Look, essentially, that was a pretty good summary by Councillor Cordover. There's very little change to the risk management policy other than aligning the types of risk with our risk matrix. As a result of the recent council workshop, the risk management framework will be reviewed by the audit panel at their February meeting, which also includes the risk appetite statement and the strategic risk register. So both those will be part of that review process. So the hope would be that after the audit panel has reviewed those, we'll bring those back to council just to confirm that the updated framework, appetite statement and register are in line with the discussions at the risk management workshop.
Thanks very much. So I'll just basically summarise, Mayor, by saying that obviously Council recognises that risk is an integral part of any management plan and part of good governance and part of putting the community at the heart of everything we do in accordance with our strategic plan is making sure that we have really sensible policies and procedures around risk and that we also try as best we can to see some of the risks coming down the road. So we've had some really valuable workshops and conversations around the Chamber about how we best mitigate and manage risk. And we're also, I think, alert and alive to the fact that there are some risks coming down the pike, some indeed which are already here, for example, anthropogenic climate change, which the Council needs to be adaptive and needs to be agile to be able to manage those risks as we move forward. So again, I thank all the staff for their involvement and their hard work on this, and I yield the floor. Thanks, Mayor.
Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. We had a really great workshop on risk. I just wanted to touch on the changes made to the types of risk that need to be managed. So previously in the policy we had strategic, financial, reputational, operational and hazard. We now have safety, financial, reputational, stakeholder, legal and environmental. So very pleased to see that stakeholders have been included, or the risk of stakeholders has been included as a risk. And thank you for that. I just wanted to ask, in terms of that stakeholder risk, how will that risk be managed? Is there a plan for that?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Look, I think the first thing we need to do is get our documentation in order, and I think there's a recognition that stakeholder risk is now essentially a high risk activity for council, and our appetite, sorry, and council's appetite is quite low for our dealings with stakeholders. So I guess that's probably the first port of call. The management group, when we meet on a fortnightly basis at one of our meetings, we always have a discussion around risk-related activity, and one of the key focus will be looking at the changes to the risk appetite statement and particular stakeholder risk and what that means for council and how we go about attempting to manage and minimise the risk from the activities that we undertake. So I think that'll be the first port of call, will be those discussions at the management level.
Thank you, and thank you for listening to the feedback at the workshop and incorporating that into this policy.
Councillor Winchley.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple of questions. Page 57, 4.6, it states not in annual but in the corporate plan. There's a change to that. I just wondered why there was a change.
Mr. Breen.
So I said again, page 57, 4.6 it was.
Yeah, so through you, Mayor. Essentially, the risk management information will now be contained within the corporate plan, so we don't specifically... it's considered as part of the strategic plan, but we don't include any information in the strategic plan on our risk information, so risk framework or risk policies. But certainly within the corporate plan, there will be information made available to the public in regards to our risk management activities. That's the reason for the change.
Thank you. And just a question about the risk register. Noting that it will be updated on a regular basis. So is that document something that councillors are aware of? Wondering a bit more about understanding that.
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Essentially the risk register is our list of strategic risks for council. You would have had a look at that at the risk workshop. And essentially, it's something that is primarily a discussion with the audit panel. So the audit panel, to a certain extent, have carriage of the risk register, and we have some discussions there. So it comes forward from management, goes to the audit panel, and gets adopted there. It goes into our risk framework, and then gets discussed at the risk workshops that we have with council. So essentially in February we'll be bringing that document back to council to say, look, this is the current view of the strategic risk register in terms of management and the audit panel, and we'll be getting feedback from the council at that point in time.
Councillor Cordova, sum up.
I commend the motion. Thanks.
Okay, the motion is that Council approved the updated risk management policy 3.10. It was moved by Councillor Cordova, second by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motions carried unanimously. We move on. We are up to the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993 Delegated Authority Policy 1.1A, moved by Councillor Street, second by Councillor Westwood. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. The motion before us is for the Delegated Authority Policy for Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993. There are two primary objectives in the update. They are legislative changes and also a change to council personnel. I think that the report adequately explains the changes that are in the existing policy, along with a change of
name to the policy, just to Planning Authority Delegations Policy 1.1A. And I commend the motion to Council.
Now the light's on, so I'll ask a question. A lot of this refers to various components of the Act and Act or Acts. Have we, just because it'd be very simple to get to make a mistake, has this gone through, or has it ever gone through an audit panel, or had someone check the check that we've got ticked every box?
No, it hasn't gone through an audit panel. We don't have an audit panel set up for that. So the legislation changes that came out are long but short, if that makes sense. They're quite long in all the words that they had, and the tranche changes were given to us by the state government, so it was quite specific and we knew what was coming. So it's relatively easy to go through the tranche changes to make sure that we've picked up those different legislative changes. So when the bill came out, obviously they don't release the entire Act. You're not reading 200 plus pages, you're just reading what the changes are. So I'm confident that these changes are fine for what has changed. In saying that, I do think it would be worthwhile for us to visit the entire Act, which is very long, to go through that to check our delegations.
Yep, fair enough. Okay. Councillor Reith.
Thank you. It's good to see that this is being updated because of those legislative changes, but also the change in personnel and titles, I should say, given that we have a new Director of Environment, Development and Community who is starting on the 6th of January. I think it would be appropriate that I noticed here that it was proposed that this policy be signed off now and be in place for 4 years until December 2024, if you look at the date at the top of the document on page 66. I wonder if it wouldn't be more appropriate to allow a period of time for the Director of Environment, Development and Community to settle into that role and then revisit this policy once the person has had a chance to do that, in case there are some other ideas or directions that that person would want to take. So it would be my suggestion, if the mover and seconder are open to it, that we amend the next review date to the 31st of March 2021, and that would allow just over a period of 3 months for the person to settle into the role and then potentially advise any additional changes that they may wish to make. I'm not sure if that is acceptable to...
So it currently says the next review date is December 24, and you're suggesting that it would say March...
31st of March 2021.
Okay. So in the motion itself, what are the words that you would suggest... the council endorsed the revise?
Probably just with a comma after the end, saying with the change to the review date, next review date to 31st of March 2021.
So mover and seconder.
Can I just ask a question of Mr. Smee, Mayor? Does that work?
Through you, Mayor, we do need to review the General Delegated Authority Report in May of 2021, so it may be advisable to align the two so we bring both policies together. There's nothing stopping us from bringing a review at any time between now and the scheduled revised date. But, yeah, I would suggest that May rather than March would be a preferable date.
I'm happy to then reword that to say 30th of May 2021.
Okay. So you're asking the mover and seconder if they'd be happy.
Oh, no, 31st. There is a 31st.
And you're...
There is 31. I have to remember my kindergarten then.
So you're asking the mover and seconder?
Yes, please.
Can I ask a question as well?
Yeah, but only because I shouldn't have done that the first time, though.
Just in relation to the 28-day time frame with the amendment to the Act, is this going to cause any issues if we don't review it tonight? Or approve it tonight, sorry?
We are.
You are.
Oh, we are.
We are.
Still are.
Okay, sorry. Yep, I'm happy.
Yeah, okay, Councillor Street, you
happy? I'm happy with the amendment.
Councillor Reid, do you want to continue?
Yep.
Councillor Cordova.
So we're done talking about the...
You can talk about it if you... Yeah.
No, I'm not interested in talking about the amendment or what, yeah. You know, the change.
No, that's fine. That's the motion on the screen is the motion that you're debating. Yeah.
Yep, that's fine. So my question, Mayor, is about 5.5. I'm looking at, pursuant to the Local Government Building and Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1993, Council delegates the following powers and functions to the General Manager and the Director of Environment, so on and so forth. So this is on either page 85 or, if you're looking at the track changes, copy 74.
Sorry, what page is this on?
I'm on the right item, aren't I?
Yeah, what
planning
page, sorry?
Authority delegations policy.
Yeah, what page are these in?
74 is the tracked changes.
Thank you. Cheers.
So my question is just about, in general terms, is there any significant extension of the powers and functions to the General Manager? Is the extension of powers and functions significant, or is it a minor extension of delegation?
Ms. Tollamore?
Through you, Mayor, some of the changes, such as the other acts, the Electricity Supply Industry Act, the Water and Sewage Industry Act, are really just clerical. It's just that it talks about that Council needs to do it, and obviously we don't want to come to a Council meeting for that. The only change that would get anywhere close to some significance really is that the General Manager... So currently in... Well, currently. Before 30th of November... The Act said that Council may amend a planning permit, so that's called a minor amendment, and it didn't make any mention of refuse or approve or issue a permit. And then when they changed the Act to introduce the time frame, they did put that in, that you may issue a permit or do a refusal. So this is suggesting that the General Manager has that refusal delegation where it can't come to a Council meeting. So it's the same as the powers he has for an ordinary planning permit.
Okay, so I'm just trying to look at this through the frame of, does this further enfranchise councillors to make decisions or disenfranchise them, for want of a better term? And what would be your analysis?
Sorry. Through you, Mayor. The minor amendments changes didn't come with any extension of time requirements. So in a planning permit, you can ask for an extension of time to make a decision. So we speak to the applicant and say, well, it's got to go to a council meeting because it's either a refuse or it's got three reps. We'd need an extension of time because the agenda lead-up time is so long to get to it. But they didn't think to put that in, or they chose not to put that in for these minor amendments. So we can't ask for that extension of time to get to a council meeting. And to get to council meetings... you know, week and a half beforehand, so you're never going to get the assessment. You may not get the assessment time to be able to get to a council meeting because you can't ask for an extension of time. So the General Manager would make that decision in that instance.
Yeah, so I guess to clarify, that means it is disenfranchising councillors in the sense that because there's not enough time to get to a council meeting, now this new provision allows for the General Manager to just take care of business and just deal with it instead of councillors dealing with it.
Yeah, and that's how it did operate historically. So rightly or wrongly, it seems, we very rarely refuse a minor amendment. It was just made under delegations before, so I don't know that any councillor here would recall a minor amendment coming up to be refused.
Okay, so in your assessment, do you see any risk associated with that provision, or you think it's okay?
I'm comfortable with it that it's the General Manager. It'll still have a report with it.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Now, going back a little bit just to page 72, and I'm looking at the track changes 60, item 60, that says notify an applicant whether the information submitted in relation to a condition of a permit is satisfactory or not in accordance with this section of the Act. My question was, aren't we doing that already? Don't we notify applicants if they're satisfactory or not?
Correct, but it's just through you, Mayor. That is correct, but it is not specified. It's just that the Act now introduces the words so that Council have to do it, so we have to laboriously have it written in the policy to make sure that it's in there.
Okay.
So with some of the other Acts, just industry knowledge of why this is so specific to Lupa, is some of the other acts which you'll see in the next report that I've got just says all powers go to the general manager, but this is has been separated into different tiers of responsibilities.
Okay.
That's why it's listed the way it is.
Okay. And then my final question was just about in 4.7 it says, and this is now 63, page 63, section 60, about halfway down the page, timing of determination of compliance with certain permit conditions, and it says it's recommended that the delegation should be extended to all staff, not just senior staff. I just wondered whether you have any commentary around that.
Stoddle.
Through you, Mayor, it just should be delegated to all staff because that's what we currently do anyway. So staff look at the conditions and the plans that come in and we notify them straight away about what they need to do. It would just be a slow things down if you were to do it another way.
Yep. And so am I right in thinking, that's roughly what I was going to suggest, is that isn't it true that by having all staff do it rather than just senior staff, you're removing a lot of bottlenecks, you're speeding up the process because all staff can make the appropriate judgment.
Well, it's
judgment.
How it operates now. Yeah. It's just that it isn't written in the legislation.
Got it. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. No other lights on. Councillor Street, would you like to sum up?
Motion is moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Mr. Councillor Westwood. I'll read it because it was changed slightly. That Council endorsed the revised Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993 Delegated Authority Policy 1.1A as attached to this report and renamed as Planning Authority Delegations Policy 1.1A and the next review date to be 31 May 2021. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. Next item is the donations, delegated authority policy, shown on page 87. Recommend a motion on page 88. Mover and seconder, please. Councillor Street, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. There is very little change this policy apart from some changes related to provisions of the Strata Titles Act 1998. I do have one question in relation to the policy, and that is whether we keep a register of the General Manager's sub-delegations under Section 64 of the Act.
Mr. Smee.
Sorry.
Through you, Mayor, yes, we do.
And with that, my contribution is finished.
Inspirational, Councillor Street. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions related to the, it feels like, additional time limits or the changes in some timeframes. We know our planning staff are under the pump and we have significant number of applications currently over the last 6 months, and I'm sure as we grow. Just wondering if staff feel that we were able to meet these additional time limits that are proposed with the existing number of staff in the planning area.
Through you, Mayor, we anticipate we won't be able to keep up with these additional timeframes as there are additional pressures and timeframes and reduced timeframes, for example, that in both reports, there's timeframes in both of them, so my comments are about both those policies, not just this one. So that is something that we need to review and consider going forward.
No other lights. Councillor Street does not want to sum up. Motion is that Council endorse the revised Delegated Authority Policy 1.1 as attached to this report. It was moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion carried unanimously. Next item is the donations policy, 3.3. Moved by Councillor Reet, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Reet.
Thank you. There is very little change to this, but I just had a question in relation to the scope. At the moment, the scope says that all requests for one-off financial assistance from persons chosen to represent Tasmania or Australia in sporting, social, economic, environmental development and or related to the wellbeing of the community. To me, the thing that was missing from that was academic pursuits. So there are a range of events or competitions, if you like, that are held, like the Maths Olympiad and science competitions that are held at a national level where people are invited to interstate.
Where are we?
And I can't...
3.1 in the pulse.
Scope, yeah. And I just can't see where those sorts of things would fit. And it sometimes I find that there's such a leaning towards rewarding people who have achieved at a high sporting level, which of course is very important and they should be congratulated and given assistance, but I would equally like to see that those students who are achieving a milestone and representing Tasmania or Australia in academic pursuits are also able to secure a grant under this policy. So I just couldn't see how it would fit, so I'd be interested in a comment from staff on whether we could add academic in there.
Mr. Smee? Sorry.
So through you, Mayor, I think that would be most appropriate.
What about artistic? Are you missing that as well?
Yeah.
Who would have thought that
academic and artistic I thought would go together, yeah. So I don't know whether it needs an actual amendment or whether we...
I reckon it does.
Okay, so, well, I moved the thing, so I can't, but I can suggest to somebody that they might like to add the words academic and artistic.
Once you're finished, I'm sure we'll hear from someone else.
So if somebody would like to do that at 3.1, that would be terrific. I would.
Councillor Fox.
I would very happily do that.
Okay, so there's a motion. We need some words, though. 3 points.
That at 3.2 of the policy, the words academic and artistic are added.
Oh, yeah. I think words should be plural. Yeah. Okay. So we've got an amendment from Councillor Fox. Would you like to debate the amendment, Councillor Fox?
It's logical.
Any other contributions? On the amendment at 3.2 of the policy, add the words academic and artistic. Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Cordova. On the amendment, all those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried. It becomes a substantive motion. Any further contributions on this? Oh, no.
Sorry, I just realised we should have probably put the word cultural in there as well. So I'm thinking of, you know, young Indigenous leaders who are invited to represent Tasmania at something.
Okay.
We don't have that one in there either.
Isn't that related to the wellbeing of the community?
Not really. I know it's a long meeting, but
Do we have to specify all these things? Can we just say that selected to represent Tasmania or Australia? We're going to support to do that, because if they're representing our state or our country, we should support them, shouldn't we?
Yeah, that could then open it up to some...
Give me an example. Okay. All right. Thank you. Good point.
Yep.
Okay. I just needed someone to suggest some words.
I would just like to suggest that we do the same thing as we did there and also add the words cultural.
Okay.
Can't suggest anything, so I will suggest that we add the word.
Yeah, let's just do this on, as opposed to an amendment, let's just do this on the agreement of the mover and seconder.
Good thinking.
So add the word, sorry, you want to just add the word.
I mean, cultural or artistic and cultural.
I think we've got the gist of it. When we do the minutes, though, we'll have to do a couple of. Because we're now under substantive, we've just amended the amendment, which we've already dealt with, so we can't actually do that.
Might just need to move an amendment, I think.
Just if Ms. Morton just takes it back to academic and artistic, and then we say, I move an amendment that at 3.2 of the policy, add the words and cultural.
Yeah. I know this is ridiculous, but yeah, we have to do it this way now, I think. No, it's all right. Yeah. Okay, moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Bastone. Okay, on the amendment, we're just adding the word and cultural, at words add and cultural. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against, okay, that's now, that is carried unanimously, becomes a substantive. Any other contributions before we wrap it up? Councillor Westwood and then Midgley.
Just a question in relation to the finance. So the annual budget of $10,000 allocated for donations is adequate to cover the inclusion of school citizenship payments. So 16 schools is 1,600. Is that the amount referred to in 5.2? The mayoral donations budget will be reduced by an appropriate amount, so up to 1,600?
Mr. Breen.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I think they're great amendments. My question on this whole policy and funds is promotion of it, and I think it's about who you know kind of thing. As a resident for a long time, I had no idea that there was such donation existed, and I guess we're caught between the fact that it's not a huge amount of money, so we don't want to promote it too widely, but yet we should let community members know that it is available, and definitely since I've been a councillor I've been able to promote it. But what are our thoughts in regards to that?
This year I don't know that I've had a single request for a donation this financial year. Last year I overspent it by about $2,000, so I don't know what's happening. Well, I expected though that COVID would actually drive more requests for donations, and I know it has, for example, in our community grants, but in this case I haven't had any. I don't know if I've approved a single, even had a request for one. But so I agree with you that we've never really had to advertise it before, because it's just sort of the amount that's come in has been spent. But if any, probably councillors are the best advocates. If you've got anyone that's doing something that's worthwhile for the community, we do have an amount of money there. I agree. Probably one for the next communications officer to have a look at, especially if we're going to underspend. Any other contributions?
What does happen, Mayor, when in the instance of an underspend?
We called it an efficiency dividend in the earlier budget.
Yeah, is there a way to actually make that better than that? So
yeah.
Something's less ad hoc?
It just would go at the end of the year. We obviously overspend in some areas and we underspend in others. And, for example, last financial year we overspent on the mayor's donations. I well and truly overspent. And this year we're heading towards a large underspend, but there'll be overs and unders all over it. Mr. Breen, have you got a better answer than I've got? It would be hard.
The three-year mean, essentially, unfortunately, accounting periods go for the 12 months, and whether you overspend or underspend, you can't carry it forward into the next financial year. So other than looking for opportunities, perhaps if you're underspending towards the back half of the year, it does become difficult to carry things forward.
Would there be any utility in adding a 5.7 under the guidelines of the policy that an over or underspend will be returned to ... arts or cultural funding, community grants, general revenue, like just to stipulate something, just so it's not...
Mr. Green.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Essentially, that would be difficult. I think that the best bet would be to try and promote the donations policy, perhaps in the second half of the year, if we're finding that it's not being uptaken at all.
Okay, any other contributions? Thanks, Ms. Morton. The motion was moved by Councillor Reid, seconded by Councillor Minchley, and it's that Council approve the updated donations policy with the addition of, at 3.2 of the policy, add the words academic, artistic and cultural. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. Next item is the Kingborough Access Policy and Change of Title to the Advisory Committee, moved by Councillor Reet, seconded by Councillor Fox. Councillor Reet.
Thank you. I appreciate that this was deferred at a previous meeting at which it appeared when it hadn't been through the Access Committee, and as you'll see from the existing policy with the tracked changes, there were quite a few amendments that were made, and we had a really robust debate about trying to, I guess, put a few more, bit more meat on the bones of the policy in terms of having people understand a little bit more about what it is to be a person with a disability and how they should be treated fairly within the community. So the amendments are there and they were all endorsed by the committee. The only issue that we have is that the name that the Access Committee put forward is not the name that now appears in this recommendation at 10B, because it says that we change the name to the Kingborough Disability Access Inclusion Advisory Committee. When the committee met last week, they unanimously objected to that because it had changed from what they'd put up, and so they've asked me to provide a to suggest that it be changed to read the Kingborough Disability Inclusion and Access Advisory Committee. So it's basically swapping around the words access and inclusion and adding and in there. They felt that that better reflected that we wanted to talk about disability in an inclusive way, and so disability and inclusion, those two words needed to be next to each other, and then access coming after that. I know that it might not sound like a significant thing to be debated, but the committee were unanimous in asking me to, for the indulgence of the council, to just change that wording if somebody would like to do that, because I can't, because I'm moving the motion.
I would be very happy to do that.
But you seconded it, Councillor Fox, so I reckon Councillor Cordova.
I can move it. So I move that.
Or I don't think you need to move, you can just suggest the words. Yeah, if you just suggest the words and then they can agree.
I suggest the words Kingborough Disability Inclusion Access and Access Advisory Committee. Thank you.
So you're asking that the words indeed be changed around.
Correct.
Is that right on the screen now?
There are... Yes, sorry, I'll just say yes.
And also the policy to become the Kingborough Disability Inclusion and Access Policy.
The mover and second are happy with what's on the screen.
I am very happy, thank you. That would and make the committee very happy as well. But, of course, we do need to then make the changes in the actual policy that's attached to reflect that name.
Yeah. And so can I ask Mr. Smee, is that with the motion as it's currently drafted, will that change the name on the policy document?
Yes, ma'am. Yep, that's fine.
Great. Then, Councillor Cordova has helpfully suggested some amendments. I'm just checking with Councillor Reet and Councillor Fox that they're happy. And they both say they're happy. Excellent. Any further contributions? Oh, sorry, I thought you wanted to... No?
One quick comment to say it's really important to listen to our committees and their voices, and they're our voice for the community. So thank you. We have Councillor Reet to bring this to our attention, that they're able to see this and discuss it.
Councillor Cordova.
Sorry, I'd just like... Thank you, Mayor, for the indulgence. I'd just like to also echo Councillor Midgley and say that as a council, I'm just so grateful for the work of this committee, and I thank Councillor Reet as well for her work with the committee. The committee is made up of people who have a lived experience of disability, and those in advocacy roles for people with disability, and it's a wonderful expression of the council's interest and commitment to the people of Kingra that we do consider access in everything we do, so that it's not just a tack on the end, that it's something that we include as a kind of whole of local government approach, for want of a better term. Everybody provides useful insights and expertise through their own lived experience, and that's why the real value of this committee and its expression through our policies and procedures and the things we invest in as councillors, as a council, I just think that it's really valuable and it does not go unnoticed. I think it's a terrific committee and does terrific work. And all the way through the municipality, you will be seeing expressions and implementations of the work that this committee has done over years and years. And we see that in the infrastructure. We see that in even the way that we talk on the council. So I just think that often we don't even... I'm personally very grateful for their work, and I think that the dividends are being paid throughout our municipality, so more power to them. Thanks.
Councillor Reid? Nope. Okay, so the motion moved by Councillor Reid, seconded by Councillor Fox, is that Council A, and it's a little bit different to what's in the report, so I'll read it, A, endorse the revised Kingra Disability Inclusion and Access Policy as attached to this report, and B, confirm the change of title of the Kingra Access Advisory Committee to the Kingra Disability Inclusion and Access Advisory Committee. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motions carried unanimously. Next item is on page 114, and it's the Kingra Youth Policy. There's a recommended motion on page 115. Anyone like to move it? Moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I note this policy was last reviewed in 2016 and it has 13 principles that guide the youth strategy, and the principles are very important. It's great that we have these for our young people in Kingra: access, participation and consultation, social inclusion, building on diversity, equity, respect, communication, responsiveness, effectiveness, efficiency, building community capacity, confidentiality and accountability. And the policy will be implemented by Council's youth services staff and other Council staff as required. And these are great principles that guide their work practices and the strategy. I had a question after working in this sector and a couple of other Councils in Tasmania and New South Wales. Some Councils have a strategy only and not a policy and a strategy. I'm wondering, it's great we have the both documents, I'm just wondering why some councils choose just to have a strategy and why some councils have policy and a strategy.
Just me.
Through you, Mayor, largely historical. We originally had a policy but no strategy, and I think it was recognised that the policy in itself is just a very high-level document that doesn't contain much detail in relation to how we will implement it, and so the strategy is where all the heavy lifting's done. The policy provides the building blocks for that strategy, but we've continued with both, I guess, because the policy is Council's statement of its commitment to our youth in a very high level manner, and the strategy contains all the detail in relation to the consultation that's been undertaken and the specific actions that the team will undertake in relation to endeavouring to meet the principles that are contained within the policy. But the reason we've got both, yeah, they could be rolled into one, but this council has in most instances both a policy and a strategy that go hand in hand but are separate.
Thank you. And so were young people or any other youth services consulted at all regarding any of the changes in the policy?
Through you, Mayor, certainly the policy over the years has been developed in consultation with our Youth Advisory Committee. The changes this time round, I don't know if they have been run past our Youth Advisory Committee, because that's been in recess due to COVID. So I doubt that the very minor change within this policy has been through our Youth Advisory Committee.
Thank you. And just a note under the social inclusion, it's a great point which adds, which may include subsidised rate regarding paid programs to identified community members experience financial hardship. I'm sure that some of the fantastic arts and cultural and programs that the youth services team do run, so it's fantastic we can be inclusive regarding that. Another question about we have the youth policy and the strategy, but we don't have anything really from, we've got the 12 to 25, but what about the 0 to 12? Have we looked at all that area or combining perhaps children and young people?
Through your mayor, certainly when we used to run a family daycare service, we had a children's services strategy that the family daycare service provided our primary means of addressing that. And we have considered whether we would have a family policy or a family strategy, but it's been largely one of resourcing in relation to why that hasn't been progressed.
Thank you, Mr. Smee.
Okay, moved by Councillor Mitchell, second by Councillor Cordover, that Council endorse the revised Kingborough Youth Policy 4.5 as attached to this report. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion's carried unanimously. Next item is the Development Services Quarterly Report. That starts on 121, and there's a recommended motion on page 127. Remover and a seconder. Moved by Councillor Cordover and seconded by Councillor Meachley. Councillor Cordover.
Thanks very much, Mayor. So we are looking at the Development Services Quarterly Report. I think the main takeaway message, which is quite interesting, is that developments are on the up and up. Planning permits applications over the past 6 years are going a lot. So as of November of this year, it's 716 for the month. And compare that to November of 2015, it was 466. So there's an ongoing development, and I think that's a testament to the fact that Kingborough is a great place to live and work and enjoy recreation, but it also is a testament to the need for our constant vigilance of developing infrastructure and services and making sure that we don't leave anybody behind in the transition to a larger municipality in terms of population and building, you know, urban development. And of course the environment is a massive issue that we need to contemplate at every point as we embrace development and economic activity. So what I thought I would do, rather than listening to me talk through it, is to ask Ms. Tyler Moore for her commentary on it and also to thank her for all her hard work on this report.
Through you, Mayor, is a commentary just about development progress or activity in development services? Both. So, yes, as pointed out, the applications continue to rise and we have exceeded, we've gone well past that that number for the total of last year, 723, already to date, and we've still got, I think it is, 8 business days left. Not that we're counting down. This only reflects the planning permit applications. Obviously, there's a number of others. Something that has decreased slightly is the subdivisions, which we haven't reflected here, just for not cluttering up the report, but certainly continuing to get a lot of development in the number of dwellings that we've got. We did have the Planning Institute awards and conference this year. It had to go online because of COVID. They still had some really great presentations, and obviously we encourage our staff to continually grow and learn in the industry and be part of that industry by attending that. So they did that. We also had 2 nominations and 1 award recipient for those awards, which is great. We nominated for Young Planner of the Year, Dasheni Bangura, and Mary McNeil had put in her student project because she's one of our staff who was finalising her master's degree at UTAS, and she won that award for a great project about tactile urbanism, and the project entailed having a parking day, meaning that you occupy parking spaces with a pop-up park, and it's something we would like to do at Kingborough. We did talk about doing it this year, but just due to busyness, unfortunately, we couldn't deliver it, but we are looking at possibly taking part in that next year because it is actually a national project by the Planning Institute of Australia and other industries as well, which will be really great. So we could either set it up in our main street or, as we know, we are pedestrianising many of our areas through the Transform Kingston project. So it's certainly in theme with that, so it's really good. The Building and Construction Industry Bill, we've gone through that. You've obviously passed the two policy amendments to change those timeframes. It does make things a bit busier. It takes a lot of work for us also to prepare the back end of the software programs that we have to do, writing all the additional letters. There's a fair bit of background work that has to go into these changes, but we're there. We are still waiting for the industry of TAS Networks to give us details about what they want referred to them. So I think it's a great change that they've done it. So currently in planning applications, you refer certain applications to TAS Water so that they can build the infrastructure and so forth. But TAS Networks was never referred to, which is odd. They've obviously rectified that, except for they've just done the wording that if planning officers think that it may affect their infrastructure, then you should refer it to them. But as we are not electricity experts, we are waiting for them to give us a list of what they should or shouldn't be referred to them. And this will hopefully help them forward plan to deliver the services to our community that we expect. So that's good. The government stimulus package, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the grants that have been offered. They've both been extended but have been reduced in part. And we are seeing an increase of applications come in for that, and it does come with a heightened stress from some of the applicants because they're really wanting to take advantage of those government grants, understandably. The Huntingfield State Government Residential Development, I believe that the General Manager may have informed, so we've already got the application. I can't recall in this report if we'd had the roundabout. Yes, we've had the roundabout. We've received the roundabout, and last week, we met with the applicants who are looking to lodge the subdivision. The subdivision will be in four stages, so they won't apply for the whole estate. It will be broken up to four stages, and they are looking to lodge that shortly. And there are some, they're still waiting on some other additional reports and information to be able to submit that. The Department of State Growth Park and Ride Development applications have both been received, so that's the Huntingfield one, which is essentially formalising the existing park and ride that exists up there, and the other one is on Browns Road, where I believe that a number of tradies park in that area as it is. I don't know if I'm actually unfamiliar with whether there's commuters that park there or not, but certainly they're both in progress for assessment, which is good to see that. The local planning provisions, that's the new planning scheme coming to the planning scheme. We had our post-lodgement meeting. Sometime after that meeting, they gave us the written correspondence with that. So at the meeting, we just basically discussed the essence of what they were after and what they were looking for. But it's not a post-conference to consider the actual merits of what we're proposing. It's just more them making sure that we have all the elements that they are required to be able to, say, move on to the next phase. And we're hoping to get that response back to them early next year. And then we will wait from there to see if we have more conferences. And chances are we will, because lots of the other councils do. I think, you know, some councils have had up to five post-lodgement conferences. So it's only after all that is finalised that we would then progress to the public notification of the draft planning scheme. And as we've indicated before, we've really developed a strong consultation document for how we're going to do that and how we're going to deliver it, which we will run the councils through when we get closer to the time, because I think if there's too much of a lag of time, we'll just have to revisit it. But of course, if councils have questions about that, we could always answer it, and we are continually answering questions of the members of the public who contact us regarding the new planning scheme. Then we have a series of planning scheme amendments, Kingston Park Specific Area Plan. We're just waiting for the final decision from the Planning Commission. That hearing was 24th of November. We expect that it is likely to just come through following that. We have the correction of the incorporated documents section, and we're just waiting to hear whether there'll be a hearing for that or not, but there were no submissions, so there's not really a need for a hearing unless the TPC wants to ask us particular questions. The planning review update table is at the end, and the planning appeals update. So we've had actually quite a lot of appeals lodged by either, mostly by neighbours, but most of them have been resolved during the mediation process, which is good. The mediation process can be, you know, there's a lot of work in preparing, just responding to the applications for appeal, and then the there's often a meeting on site for mediation to see if it can be resolved, to see if there's a, something that people agree to. We do have some instances where there's very little basis for the appeals as well, and they have been withdrawn. And naturally, as planning is busy, building and plumbing are very busy as well. So there's always a lag time at the peak of applications as they need to get through the process and then lodge their building applications. And you can see in the chart there the number of statutory inspections, plumbing and building applications. It is less for these years, but the numbers, if you actually look at the numbers, there's very little difference. And we expect the peak from the later part of this year to be seen early next year at those building applications. And, of course, again, because they're trying to get those grants, they need to get those building applications in place so they can get their contracts signed. The chart obviously doesn't show all the work that the Building and Plumbing Department do. A lot of it is to do with compliance, in the sense, the same with the planning team as well. There's a lot of compliance work, which can be a huge amount of work and correspondence with neighbours and the people who have caused the offence and things like that, which isn't reflected in there. And in the attachments is the planning review update as well.
Thank you so much. That was really comprehensive and really appreciated. So I've got... firstly, I also want to congratulate Dashini Bangara and Mary McNeil on their winning of the awards with the Planning Institute of Australia. It's just a wonderful, wonderful achievement, and they should be very proud. I had a question, actually, about the government stimulus package for the building industry COVID-19 recovery as it relates to housing affordability and rental shortage. Is the expectation that as these grants ease off, there will be fewer planning and development applications? That's the first question.
Ms. Tolliman.
Sorry.
Through you, Mayor, I don't think that I'm qualified enough to make the prediction about what the impact on the rental industry is. Based on the trajectory of applications, I'd say we will continue to see an increase. Something else that we can note from our area is knowing land releases through the big subdivisions. So Whitewater and Spring Farm have still got stages left to release. That'll have an impact, and obviously the Hunting Field development, although that's going to be some time off till they actually land release. But given the size of those allotments, a lot of those are going to trigger the need for planning permits as well.
Okay, so I guess it sounds like it remains to be seen if the easing off of the grants, it may not actually result in fewer development applications. I mean, the growth trajectory in Kingborough is a steep one, so it seems like irrespective of grants or no grants, that it will continue to rise. Keeping that at the forefront of mind, I note that this week the Mercury has been reporting that a report is going to Hobart City Council, a report on how to cap the number of short-stay accommodation properties in Hobart is being sought by Hobart City Council following revelations that the housing shortage has returned to pre-COVID-19 levels. When and if that takes place, will there be learnings? Is that something that the Planning Department here at Kingborough will be looking at?
That relevance, doesn't appear
is that
to...
in the report?
Yeah, it's not in the report, Councillor Cordova.
Okay. My next question is about Kingston Park specific area plan. It says that Council's now waiting on the final decision from the TPC. Is there... do you anticipate any, like, issues with that, or it's going swimmingly?
Through you, Mayor. No, I don't anticipate anything. This is the second hearing, and there wasn't a lot that came out of the second hearing that wasn't heard at the first hearing, so I think it should go through.
That's great. And my final question is about, with the building and plumbing and that chart that shows this, there's always, like, way more statutory inspections. Is there anything to be alarmed about by that? I mean, why... Why such a difference?
Through you, Mayor. The statutory inspection, so in building and plumbing, the Building Act used to require that council did all building permits and building pertinence inspections, and that was given away and privatised. Some councils continued to do it, and we did continue to do it till 2016. So that part doesn't create as many inspections, but it's the plumbing inspections that do, because there's no privatisation of the plumbing industry, which is a good thing. And we do all those statutory inspections, so there's often at least three statutory plumbing inspections that are required to sign off the that part of those Building Act permits.
Councillor Mitchley, then Councillor Westwood. Councillor Mitchley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. A couple of questions for me, and thank you so much for sharing all the great work that has been done. I have some questions in regards to the park and ride development, kind of just understanding the process, really. So I understand it has been out for public comment, but it's then come to council as a... I'm just wondering where the public comment kind of has come into and what's
as
the process.
As a development application?
But
there is separate... There was a process that the department put in place that's separate to the planning scheme, which was just not so much of an engagement. It was just a... what's it called? The website thing you had?
Pinpoint.
Yeah. That's not a part of the planning. It's just a consultation or an engagement piece where they tell you what they're going to do.
Okay.
And then ignore any feedback.
Right. That's what I'm sort of trying to comprehend, kind of put all that together.
Yeah.
Okay.
So do you want Ms. Tylemore to talk about the the development application process?
Perhaps, yes, just to clarify. Because they've gone out for public comment, they've put in a DA, where does then the public get to have a further comment, perhaps?
Just through you, Mayor, if I could just clarify, are you talking about the park and rides or the Hunting Field subdivision?
The park and ride.
The park and ride.
So it's gone out for a social pinpoint comment, and I thought that was finishing and they were doing a report next year, but then they've lodged a DA, so I'm wondering how it all matches up.
Through you, Mayor, I'm actually not familiar with what the consultation was. I think Mr. Ferrier knows a bit more about the consultation that occurred, but it was outside the planning process. So they've just lodged that planning permit application. As part of that planning permit application, they will be discretionary applications, so they will go out for the 14 days public notice as per any planning application. Three or more representations or a refusal will mean that it will come to a council meeting, and obviously there will be appeal rights for the applicant and any representors.
Okay, thank you. So what's the estimated date for it then to go out for public comment through that DA process?
Through you, Mayor, it's currently has a request for further information on some... it doesn't have further information. We're doing the initial assessment for those ones at the minute. If there's requests for further information, then it's up to them how long they take. Let's just say if they did and they had a couple of weeks, then it's the 42 days continues from there.
Okay. So sometime next year, hopefully by the early...
Not this year.
No, definitely. So I guess that's the same. It's a similar question around the roundabout. That's a similar process then as well.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Do we know... So you mentioned that the Hunting Field development will be in four stages. Do you know at all what stage the social housing component will be?
Not a planning...
Is that a planning matter. Question? Oh. Okay.
It's scattered.
Yes, it is scattered. Should be built first. That's all of my questions for now. Thank you.
Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. Thank you for the report, Ms. Tyler Moore. On the Hunting Field residential development, I was just wondering about the master plan. So we've received a development application for the roundabout, but it notes in here that the subdivision application and master plan, should they choose to lodge one for approval, have not yet been submitted. So is there a process for council to approve the master plan, and how will that come to the planning authority?
Ms. Tyler Moore, wait for this.
Through you, Mayor, it's not mandatory that they do the master plan. So when they created the order, they put it in there. I think since that time that there would be a master plan, but it's not mandatory. They can just default from the acceptable solution to the discretionary path, and that's the path that we believe that they're going down, and that's what they've indicated thus far. In the roundabout application, in the very long documentation that came with it, included the diagram of the master plan, which is effectively the same plan that we've seen throughout the whole communications with them, but they've indicated to us that they're not going to be submitting that seeking endorsement. If they did do that, then it's likely it would come up to a council meeting for the councillors or the council to endorse that master plan. So just something that may be of interest is that master plans do get done from time to time on much bigger developments, big growth corridor type developments. This is a big development for us, but it can be limiting in what it delivers if they vary, because the market might change or they might realise what they want to change, and having a master plan can be difficult. Also, a master plan can be occasionally can be over prescriptive. We do have a master plan like for Kingston Green, and it can make things difficult. So I guess it's my opinion that it's not the end of the world that there's not a master plan for it, because at the end of the day they're making the application for the subdivision, and then we see what the development is and we have those controls over that.
How about for the public open space components, like the little bike park and those things that were included in the master plan to make it a nice place to live for those residents?
Through you, Mayor, that would can just come in as part of the subdivision. So until we see the application lodge, we don't know those details. There is a risk that they don't deliver what they say that they're going to deliver. So what often happens with subdivisions is that you tie them, and certainly this is probably something that we're getting better at since other larger states that we've done, is that timing and that requirement for embellishment of public open space. So, as you know, because we've discussed it tonight, the public open space policy is there, but linking it to what stages that it's to occur rather than leaving it till the end necessarily, because a developer may choose not to do stage 5 or stage 6 or whatever it is where it's linked in. So we need to find out that detail earlier on in the piece and find out what those outcomes might be, but it's also worth being mindful that that may change what they've suggested they're going to do in there depending on what other outcomes that they had in there. So we know that there are Aboriginal artefacts in there, we know that there's significant flora fauna in the area and are surrounding the area, so that may actually change what they had initially intended, but until we receive the application we have those details, we don't know that for sure.
And so if council, would it be council that approves the master plan or the planning authority?
Through you, Mayor, if there was a master plan, there's no specific delegation about it, but we anticipated what we would do is that it would come to a council meeting for endorsement, and it depends on the nature and the wording around that approval of the master plan as to how far you can depart from that, because if, for the reasons I said before, you know, they may change what they want to do, but in terms of promises of what's going to be delivered, that should be considered definitely as part of the subdivision and tied in with things like Part 5 agreements.
So if the DAs for each of the four stages come to the planning authority and they don't include all of the nice things that were in the master plan, is there any way of making those things attached to the approval of the development application, or can the development application be approved without that master plan overlay?
Through you, Mayor, it can be approved without the master plan, and that's typically what we do. So, for example, the two estates that we're familiar with, Whitewater and Spring Farm, you know, they're of a similar size, that they could have had master plans and they didn't, and I think we cannot have identified some of the issues that have arisen out of that. We can still tie it in with the planning permit and those requirements that they do deliver the open space. So something that's unusual for this site is that that public open space area is far more than the 5% required by the policy. But at the same time, they're sort of handing it over, and that's where council decides how we're going to manage that open space, because that's now a cost on council to manage all that infrastructure and those additional paths and all the equipment that may go in there. And is that really something we want to take on? If it's something that they're providing for the subdivision, that's a decision to be made, and we have asked those questions about how they're going to deal with that. And they haven't directly said to us that they're going to hand it over, but that's yet to be seen how they're going to do that. So, yes, there does need to be a bit of caution about how we get that and what stage.
Oh, thank you. Then just in relation to the planning review update, just a couple of comments. At 8, recommendation 8, that resourcing be made available to upgrade the current IT planning software. Just to reiterate that I am interested in that coming as part of budget deliberations, so that councillors can make a decision regarding the priority of that, because it is part of this report. So I guess I don't want it cut out as an option before it gets to councillors. So I'd like to see that. The fact sheets. So this says here this recommendation is completed. There are 14 fact sheets on the website. Have we added any extra fact sheets since December 2019?
Through you, Mayor, there has been one, and I'm just trying to think of which one it is now, but we have updated the other ones in accordance with changes in policies and revisited them. We're really looking forward to doing those fact sheets again when we get our new planning scheme. It's very unfortunate that it's taking forever to get to the new planning scheme, because we don't want to invest too much time into this. So those 14 fact sheets are separate to the ones that we have. There's another 16 fact sheets that talk about the zone. So if you're in general residential zone or low density residential zone, very unattractive fact sheets, unfortunately. But it does tell you how that works. So we're not going to change those until we get to the new planning scheme, because that's just not good use. But certainly if councillors or the public think that there is a particular topic that warrants a fact sheet, then we're always happy to look at it. And we are sort of making those changes within the team to see where we need those gaps, because obviously it's the staff that get the inquiry. So if you get 50 phone calls about a water tank, then let's have a fact sheet on it.
Yeah. That makes sense. And in terms of recommendation 16, the promotion of a pre-lodgement service, have we promoted the pre-lodgement service?
Through you, Mayor, it's promoted through our website that it's available, but no, we haven't taken an ad out in the Mercury or anything like that. And certainly customers that call us directly are aware of that. They're receiving it in that instance. And we often encourage them, because sometimes I might just say, oh, look at this block, and then we say, okay, well, when you look at that block and you got closer, come in and we can discuss it with you. So it is promoted in that form.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to say that when I read that on the 20th of, I've lost it now, 2.5, on the 20th of November, Pitt and Sherry lodged a DA for park and ride facilities at Firthside, and here we were 10 days later on the 30th at a workshop giving them feedback and advice on that, and they'd already lodged the DA. Hooray for consultation. Okay, no other lights are on. Moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley, that the Development Services Quarterly Report be noted. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried. What have we got? Does anyone need... Do we just want to power through? Yeah. Okay. Development Services Quarterly Report, we've done that. Next one is Appointment to Council Special Committees. There's a recommendation on page 131. Before we start, I thought I might just run through how I thought this would work, and then you can yell at me and tell me that's a silly way to do it.
Sorry? Oh, good. It's nice. Oh, good. Well, what I was going to do is sort of, because we can't really move a second, we would just run through the list and ask for who wants to nominate for each one. And then where there is more than one person, if that occurs, then we'll have a ballot. Ms. Morton's all ready to go with... Mr. Smee's all ready to go with ballot papers, and we'll have a closed ballot. And we work through like that. Hello.
Okay. There is no such council special committee, the Kingborough Community Enterprise Centre.
Oh, yes.
In the articles of association, in 24.6, this was written in 2001, it said, in the first board of management, there would be someone from the Kingborough Chamber of Commerce, someone from Anglicare, someone from the Kingborough Council and the Department of State Development. And then it says, the provisions of this clause 6 shall cease to apply to the board of management elected to the second or any subsequent meeting. So there is no council rep on it.
So you're saying you don't... As the chair, you booted us off the committee?
No, you were booted off right from 2001.
Sorry, we've been a while ago.
But let me tell you that we have made sure that we have changed it so that it's not at all ambiguous. But you've never been on it.
So you're saying that when we move the motion, we shouldn't be moving anyway?
We should not move anything to do with
that. And you're the chair of the committee as it stands anyway?
Yes, I'm the chair of the committee.
So, for practical purposes, there won't be a change, but we should note for next time that we're not entitled to a spot. Yep, just won't move it when we...
Okay.
Yep, good. Okay, any other comments, particularly on the process, before we start? Because we're kind of out of order here at the moment. Okay, going down the list, Cobbing Seacell need a proxy. We can have ballots if you... So councillor mutually. Oh, sorry, we have missed one. Taz Water. We'll do that next then. Who wants to be the proxy for Taz Water? We can actually have that as Mr. Arnold, yeah. And a lot of councils do. And actually, I think you should have just recommended that because he's. Yeah. And councillor Westwood, you will never ever be available on a Wednesday at two o'clock in Launceston. Yeah, good one. Thursday, it's at 3. Quarterly. So, Council, I think we should make that. Yep. I haven't actually spoken to Mr. Arnold about it, but is everyone happy with that? Then we've talked about copying being Councillor Minchley. The next one is the Kingborough Access Advisory Committee. Yeah, would anyone else like to nominate that isn't Councillor Reese? No. Councillor Reese? Next one is the Bicycle Advisory Committee. Who would like to nominate for this item? Councillor Fox and Councillor Midgley. Anyone else? Oh, we'll move along and we'll do the ballot at the end. Channel Heritage Museum. Councillor Fox and Councillor Bastone. Good. Oh, okay. All right. Councillor Bastone. So it's just Councillor Bastone for that one. Cycling South, who would like to nominate for that? Councillor Midgley. And Councillor Fox. Okay. Yeah, we'll do the other one first. So, okay. The next one is the Huon Valley Kingborough Tourism Reference Group. I understand Councillor Wass wants to be nominated again. Would anyone else like to nominate? Nope. Councillor Wass. Next one is the Kingborough Community... we're not talking about that. Kingborough Community Safety Committee. Councillor Westwood. Anyone else? Councillor Westwood. Next one is the Audit Panel. Who'd like to be on the Audit Panel? Councillor Fox. Councillor Street. Anyone else? Tasmania Polar Network. Councillor Cordova. So, essentially two ballots, and it's for the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee. Mr. Smee is going to distribute some ballot papers. All you have to do is write the name of the councillor you choose. It is confidential, and Mr. Smee will count them up and just tell us who won, and we'll take a motion and move. Yeah. No, just the first one, the bicycle access advisor, bicycle K-back. So, thanks. Just while we're waiting for that, does someone want to move and second? Oh, we don't have a motion really to move. I can't do that. And whoever loses has to say the whole thing's rigged and take a court case to try and change it all. Councillor Midgley has been chosen. Councillor Fox, does this mean you'd like to do this cycling south?
Councillor Midgley is the president of that already, so okay. I'm happy to withdraw.
Okay. So in that case, we have I think that there's no other contested spots, are there? We just need Councillor Fox's name on the audit panel one. Ms. Morton, would anyone like to move or second the motion? Moved by Councillor Cordova, second by Councillor Westwood. Any discussion or debate? Councillor Mitchell.
Thank you, Mayor. I would like to speak because I had a lot of deliberations in regards to putting myself forward for the Kingborough Bike Committee, and I would like to acknowledge and thank Councillor Fox for her wonderful work over the last 2 years, and also the many years prior to that, I understand, before Councillor Atkinson. I understand currently that they are working on the Kingborough Bike Plan, and that is a very significant piece of work and really exciting for the future. And I'd like to state on public record that I welcome all councillors to attend the KBAC meetings, and if there is subcommittee meetings, and I welcome Councillor Fox to continue and attend those meetings, and I very much value her expertise, and I think we are very fortunate and lucky as a council to have two councillors who are interested in bike-related matters. Personally, I've been a cycling activist for about 20 years, and I sort of pinch myself, really, that I can sit in a chair and have such a possibility to chair the meeting for the community going forward with the next 2 years. But I'd really like to acknowledge Councillor Fox and thank her for the work that she has done. And it was a really... I didn't take it lightly to put myself forward as chair, but I thank you for the vote.
Okay. Further contributions? Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. I'd be very keen to collaborate and work with you as the new president. I know that the subcommittee has had about 6 months of very hard work, and on Friday is the last meeting of that committee before it goes to council staff for work and then to council. And it's very detailed, and there are some very high-level professional members of this committee, and I think it's going to be an amazing document when we're finished, and I think it'll be a credit to the committee as well as to council, and I wish you all the best in your role. Thank you.
Okay, any further comments before we close debate? In that case, the motion was moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Westwood. As the council resolved to appoint councillors to special committees of council and external organisations as follows. In those dots, we've added Mr Arnold to Tas Water. We've added Councillor Midgley to the Copping
CCEL. Is that right? Yeah. Council, the Access Advisory Committee is Councillor Reid. The Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee is Councillor Midgley. Channel Heritage Museum is Councillor Bastone. Cycling South is Councillor Midgley. Huon Valley Tourism Reference Group is Councillor Wass. The Kingborough Community Safety Committee is Councillor Westwood. The Audit Panel is Councillor Street, Councillor Fox. And the Tasmanian Polar Network is Councillor Cordova. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. So, for anyone still watching, well done to you. Yep, that was very good. Well done. Have a great Christmas. There's not many people watching. Have a great Christmas from all of us here. We've, it's been a weird year, but look forward to seeing you over summer. Thanks very much. Oh, the ballot. Oh, I'll do that once the tape's off. I don't need to do that with a. With the tape off? Yep. I'll just keep. Yeah. Just need a motion to destroy the ballot papers. Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Westwood. The motion is will the ballot papers be destroyed. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. Cool. We're off. The confirmation of items we dealt with in closed session. In accordance with the local government meeting procedures, we, by absolute majority, move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, application for leave of absence, purchase of Mount Lewis Road tinderbox, and general manager's annual performance review. Mover and seconder, please. Moved by Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against. Motion's carried unanimously. In accordance with Kingborough Council meetings, audio recording guidelines policy, the open session of Council is now closed and the open session is adjourned at 9:30 p.m. So we're now in closed session.